annual report to Parliament for Parliament to do its role of oversight. So that is why we're here today, to check whether we've been able to perform according to the plans that we submitted to the Parliament, and also to check whether the budget has been used for the people that was intended for. So without the waste of time, we're looking at our agenda. The second item is the apologies. I've got only one apology for the chairperson who is not well. She will not be part of this meeting today. I don't know whether there's any apology from the side of teacher and also from the side of our road committee, but if there's any, can be presented for accordingly.
From the side of Peter, we've got the chairperson of the board, Mr. Kevin Zeru, on my left hand side, and on my extreme left is Mr. Jun Zeru, who's the vice chairperson of the board. The two of them are representing the board of Peter, which comprises the two board members. And then from the side of management, it is myself, Matipo Matana, and on my right hand side, we've got Toko Zani, who's the CFO, and behind me, we've got the CEO of Peter, Mr. Mokomuze Khan. We were supposed to appear before two portfolio committees, the portfolio committee of the Department of Labor and the transport one. We actually have been told that we're going to appear before the transport first and thereafter go to the portfolio committee. And their delegation had been that we should bring two office bearers and three managers.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Members, can we also introduce ourselves? I'm Pumzi Langonya Mabila, acting chair of the committee today.
So we can also be a member of the committee.
This is my member of the committee.
Thank you so much, all members of the committee.
J.J. Magu, a member of the committee.
Mr. Alexa, a member of the committee.
Okay, thank you very much for the introductions that have been made so far. Without the waste of time, members, can we allow Tita to brief us on their annual report so that they can be able to attend the second meeting with the committee on labor? Can I then hand over this opportunity to Tita?
Thank you, Chairperson. We have distributed the copy of the report itself, but we've also done a narrative of the report, focusing a lot on non-financial information, and just like incorporate both. Now, our presentation is going to cover a few things. We felt government side and both on management side, and also speak English on our mandate. We then felt it was important to update the committee on the issues that were raised previously. The TTAP board and some senior managers appeared before the portfolio committee of labor 2 years before, and there were issues that were raised there, which we just wanted to update this committee, even though this committee is new. Then we will then go on to the performance against our service level agreement. The way in which we structured, we sign a service level agreement annually, and we sign it between the Department of Labor and the CETA, and it is upon that service level agreement that performance is expected to be undertaken in a specific year. We will then divide that SLA performance into two areas. We will focus on the non-financial performance side, but we will also speak about our financial performance, including the audit opinion that was expressed by the Auditor General. Then we felt it was important to contextualize our performance in this year by doing a two-year comparison of the previous year and this year, just to see how we have performed, both on the financial side and the non-financial side. We will then obviously speak a lot about gaps and constraints that we have encountered as an institution and the remedial measures that we have undertaken in order to make sure that those gaps do not mitigate progress in the organization. Now, in terms of the vision, our vision is to have skills for sustainable growth, development, and equity in the transport sector. Our focus is on the transport sector as a whole, both in the private sector as well as in the public sector. Now, this includes all organizations in the transport sector. Now, our mission is to facilitate that vision using a framework of learning so that we can enhance the level of skills in the transport sector based on the funds and the budgets that are available to us in a specific year. Our driving force is for us to provide best quality service for our stakeholders. Now, the way we are established in terms of the Skills Development Act, which was amended in 2008. It was established, it was 2000 and it was amended in 2008. The main aim of the Skills Development Act is for us to promote education and training and development in the transport sector. And the way we are structured is that we've got what we call chambers. Chambers are the subsectors within transport that focus on a number of modes of transport. So we have a chamber, which is the maritime chamber. It focuses on the shipping industry. We've got the road passenger, which focuses a lot on the buses. Road freight is on trucks. Taxi, it focuses on meter taxis and minibus taxis. Then we've got a rail sector that focuses on the rail. Aerospace, self-explanatory, the aviation sector. Freight handling deals with warehousing. When goods are moved either using any form of transport, there is a way in which at the harbors and at the warehouses that they should be handled in a specific way. Then we've got another subsector, which is forwarding and steering, that focuses on logistics, the movement of goods on our roads. The way we structure, we are not necessarily in all provinces, but we are having direct representation in Gauteng, which is where our head office is. We have offices in Durban and in Cape Town. Then in order for us to be able to have maximum reach throughout the country, we have what we call indirect representation in the remaining six provinces. This we do in the form of making sure that we participate in the skills development fora in provinces, in premier offices, led provincial growth development strategy meetings, and all other skills development structures. What this means is that in the other six provinces, TTA is not necessarily having that direct presence, but we do work with the Department of Transport, and we also work with the Department of Labor. Now, with our transfer to the Department of Higher Education, we will then be working with the Department of Education just to make sure that we are able to maximize our delivery in the country. Now, our mandate derives from the National Skills Development Strategy, which makes it very clear and explicit what a CETA is supposed to do. Our first thing that we have to do is to develop and implement the sector skills plan, upon which we will then identify critical and scarce skills in the sector. Then we have to make sure that the quality education and training Now, flowing out of our mandate, we then have identified the following goals for the organization. That we've got to prioritize and communicate critical and scarce skills for growth. We've got to promote and accelerate quality training, promote the employability of people in the sector, and assist designated groups to be able to get into a workplace, to be able to acquire skills, in some cases to be self-employed. And one of the most fundamental things for us to actually see that the quality and the provision of the training that happens is relevant for the sector. Now, the previous 2 years, in the year 2006 to 2007, there were issues raised in this organization. We went through a turbulent time, and this had an impact on corporate governance and performance of the organization. It mainly hinged on the investment that was made by this organization of about 200 million, which led to a disciplinary action being taken against my predecessor, the CEO, and the CFO that was there at the time. The impact of that was that there was underperformance during the year 2006 and 2007, with TITA getting an average score of 2.5. The way in which we are scored in terms of performance, according to the target, that we are scored out of a score of 5, and we got 2.5 in that specific year, and generally the expectation is that at least if you are said to be performing very well, you should have scored about 3 out of 5. There were negative perceptions about the viability of the organization as a going concern as a result of those of that investment. However, we want just to confirm that all obligations were met that year, and thereafter the organization was able to actually learn from the mistakes and move forward. In terms of the status quo, is that as a result of that, the organization had to reflect, they had to review their strategy, they had to look at their policies, they had to make sure that the investment policies aligned with the PSMA and treasury regulations. We had to improve internal controls and focus on corporate governance, both for the board and the staff, and we had to streamline a lot of business processes. The outcome and impact of that was that we then managed stakeholder relations, and we were able to actually get their confidence. We improved our website, we realigned our business strategy, and as a result of all those actions, our performance improved significantly in 2008 and 2009. Now, in terms of the National Skills Development Strategy, every year when we submit our report to Parliament, we've got to submit how we have performed against specific indicators that have been set for us. Now, I have just outlined a lot of indicators that are set for a CETA in a specific year, and I want to outline how we have done against all of those indicators. The first indicator that is set for any CETA is that we must have our sector skills plan disseminated. So we must undertake research in a specific year in the sector to determine demand and supply, and based on that, we will then say in the country, based on demand and supply, the scarce and critical skills are in the following sectors, in the following areas, and disseminate that information. And the sector skills plan would then contain interventions of how those scarce and critical skills would be addressed. Now, over and above the SSP, it is expected of us to disseminate this information to all skills development facilitators and also even take it to learners and the public so that they can know what are the skills and critical skills in the specific sector. In the year under review, 390 SSPs have been allocated, but from 2005 to date, 1,360 skills development facilitators have been capacitated. Our second indicator is for us to give mandatory grants to different firms. In the year under review, we gave mandatory grants to 216 large firms, and we also gave mandatory grants to 153 medium firms. And then one other indicator is for us to then give mandatory grants to levy-paying small, medium, and micro enterprises. In the year under review, we gave support to 89 levy-paying SMEs, and from 2005, we gave 1,432 SMEs discretionary grants. Another indicator is for us to support black economic empowerment through training, not necessarily giving them funding for them to be able to start their businesses. For the year under review, 195 BEs were supported and 5 BE cooperatives were also supported. In total, if you look at it from 2005, 442 BEs were supported. One of the other indicators is for us to support adult basic education and training for level 1 up to level 4. For the year under review, we supported 1,183 people for them to go through an adult basic education and training program. Indicator 2.8 is for us to support employed learners who are participating in various learning programs in their workplaces. The general one would be learnership, skills programs, apprentices, bursaries, and internships. For the year under review, through the discretionary grants that TTAP provides, 10,538 workers were participating in various learnerships and so forth. But from 2005, 3,740 workers participated in this program. And one might ask the question, why do we always refer on since 2005? The National Skills Development Strategy is a 5-year strategy that gets renewed every 5 years. So when we start from 2005, we're actually looking at the cumulative effect of what we have done over the 4 years period, which is coming to an end next year in March. The other indicator is for us to support non-levy paying entities, non-governmental organizations, community-based organizations, and community-based cooperatives. For the year under review, we supported 128 non-levy paying, 21 NGOs, 2 CBOs, and 1 CBC. We also have to support unemployed learners by giving discretionary grants to specific companies to roll out. For the year under review, we supported 1,402 unemployed learners. The other thing that is expected of the CETA is that we must provide learners an opportunity to get workplace experience so that they don't just go for training, but they get an opportunity to go for workplace experience. We have exposed 760 learners to workplace experience through funding, and they can get taken by companies for them to go and get workplace experience. The most critical thing that is expected of CETAs to do is to support new ventures, particularly for those people that are under the age of 35 and below, or what we would call youth. We have to make sure that we can give them training in how to set up businesses, and based on that training, the understanding is that they will be able to start sustainable businesses and be able to then do something with their lives. We have supported 183 new ventures for the year under review. Now, what are the performance highlights that we have seen in the year 2008 and 2009? For us to support companies, they've got to submit workplace skills plans. And we have seen an increase in the year that has passed, where we got 25% increase from last year and 30% increase from medium term. Then we also supported 4 institutes of sexual and occupational excellence. This would be what you call academies of excellence within a specific sector. It is expected that based on best practice, if there is an institution that provides training, they would then be regarded as an occupational excellence institute if they can provide best practice training and be regarded as a leading institution in training in a specific sector. For TICA, we supported 4. We also then saw an increase in the support that we gave to new venture creation. We also saw an increase for non-legitimate enterprises, but we also improved our performance score. We generally get evaluated on how we support provinces. The previous year, we had been given a score of 3, but in the year under review, we got a score of 4 based on the information that the Department of Labor has at its disposal. But we also saw an improvement in terms of our funds management from 3 the previous year to 4 this year under review. And we also got an unqualified audit opinion. 2007-8 and the years under review. And we have been able to score consistently based on a scoring system and an evaluation process that is undertaken by the department on corporate governance, whether we've got AGM, whether our board members have got for training in corporate governance and team three, are they having meetings, do we have paper trail in terms of the decisions and the resolutions that are taken by the board, are they giving strategic direction or not. And for the year under review, we have been given a score of 5. Now, in terms of financial performance, this is just to show our revenue, the way in which the Skills Development Act is laid out is that we have a specific formula that we follow. Out of the amount that we get, 10% goes to admin, 50% goes to mandatory grants, and 20% goes to discretionary grants, and the remaining 20% remains with the National Skills Fund. So this is just to show our revenue, how we distributed it according to those specific steps. Now, our total revenue and the total income that we received was 358 million, of which 41 million was used for admin. There is a specific formula that determines that a SETA can only spend 10% of its income on admin expenses. This includes salaries and operating expenses. So, from the total income that we received, the admin reserve was put aside for operating expenses. Our mandatory grant reserve was 207 million and the discretionary grant reserve was 109. Our expenditure is reflected in the second column. Our admin expenditure was 39 million. Our mandatory grant expenditure was 144. Our discretionary grant was 68. Now, we had obviously surpluses at the time when the auditors were on site on the 31st of March, which clearly there's been movement and we no longer have that surplus because it has been committed to what is needed to be committed. Now, we wanted to show on the fourth block what our expenditure is as compared to our revenue. And we wanted to compare it from the previous year. The 2007-08 comparison is at the bottom, and the 08-09, which is the year under review, is on the bottom. So we spent 73% of our total income, 94% of our admin reserve, which is 10%, and we spent 70% of our mandatory grants, and discretionary grants we spent 71%. These are figures just showing our assets and our liabilities and our total commitment. As at the 31st of March this year, we had total commitment of 245 million. In terms of finance, we have received an unqualified audit opinion. We have stayed within our admin budget of 10%. I must emphasize that if we are to exceed the 10%, we will then get an instant qualification, because it means that we are not controlling our spending. But we have been able to spend and stay within the admin budget. We have been able to increase the mandatory grants that are paid to participating companies by 37%. Even our discretionary grants, we are evaluated on our expenditure there. We got an increase of about 84%. And our score on financial performance was 4 out of comparatively from 3 in the previous year. Now, this dashboard is just to show how we have done from 2000, in fact, how we have done in the current year compared to 2007-2008. And this just shows the indicators on the left and the scores on my right. people who are starting new ventures, it was a wonderful year here this year, 2023. And for us supporting Institute of Sectional Education, it was a one and implemented one. And then we also are expected in each province to have a provider that is accredited to manage a new venture creation qualification, which remains at a 4. One of the other indicators is that there must be improvements that can be measured by SAQA to see that the quality of the programs that are delivered are of a specific level. We retain the score of 4. And in terms of equity, I must emphasize that the National Skills Development Strategy has got equity standards or its principles. They require us to support 85% black people, 54% women, and 4% disabled. And generally, we then get evaluated to see if in our program we've actually been able to respond to those principles. In the previous year, we were found to be wanting, and we had scored a 1. But in the year under review, we had actually improved to a point of getting a score of 4. In terms of governance, I have referred to it that we had received a consistent score of governance based on the evaluation that is undertaken by our existing authority. We retain the 5, and in terms of provincial linkages, how we support provinces, we improve from 3 to 4. Now, this is the most interesting part of any organization, I guess, where in interactions with your stakeholders, they will tell you what they would want to see, where they will tell you how they would prefer you service them better. What we did in our AGM in 2007 and 2008 was to really start talking to the stakeholders and say at the AGM, rather than give you a report, please tell us how we can service you better. Tell us what is it that you believe we are not doing that we could be doing better. One of the most critical challenges that was identified through those interactions with the stakeholders, not only at the AGM but in all other forums where we met the stakeholders, was that they believe we do not communicate widely with stakeholders. Most of the people would say they don't know what TITA does, they don't know what TITA's mandate is, and they felt that we needed to improve our presence in the media, in the print media, in the audio media, and all sorts of forums, so that people can know what services we offer. What we have done in response to that, I would call it constructive criticism, was for us to come up with the communications and the marketing strategy that the board approved, was for us to then come up with the policy that was approved by the board, and then we are in the process of getting a service provider that can just look at our old marketing plan and tell us how to improve it against a good practice. But I must emphasize, I had said that we stay within a 10%. That 10%, we can't spend outside it. Based on the 10%, we can only implement a strategy that we can afford. So what we currently implementing is well within what we can afford. We have also gone through, I've conducted a lot of roadshows. I had one nationally and I had 9 provincial roadshows. We continue to have provider capacity workshops in all provinces. We continue to have capacity building sessions for all SMEs, NLEPs, and NGOs in all provinces. We have what we call chambers. When I introduced the organization, I said we are split into 8 chambers. Chambers are in constant support, and they communicate with the stakeholders. They are on the ground. They do site research. They do on-site monitoring. But we've also launched an interactive website in November 2008, which we are continuously updating for those that have access to IT. We have developed 2 newsletters in the year under review. We've made many presentations to many stakeholders. And where we can afford, we then do access in the print media and on the radio. The second challenge that we are grappling with is human capital development. How do we make use of our resources at our disposal to accelerate customer orientation? How do we make our staff serve the customer and the client better? We have done, and we did an assessment, and we then take came up with a few capacity building interventions that we felt could improve customer orientation and service delivery. All of our staff were capacitated on supply chain management, on TSMA regulations. All senior managers in TITA are trained in risk management. All of the staff members were trained on contract management, because we realized managing contracts is not easy. And if you do not know what you're supposed to do, you can actually mitigate progress. All of our staff members that deal with curriculum and qualifications development have been capacitated on what is expected of them. And our staff members had to be exposed on several occasions on the service level agreements that we signed with the Department of Labor, so that in their actual rollout of their plans, they must understand how it impacts on the organization's service level agreement. We also have committee members that have been capacitated on what are the key things that they should be doing in support at the government level. We've also then, we do a lot of artisan training, which is always the need is greater than the funds that are available. We've actually capacitated people on what the specific requirements of the Skills Development Act is with regard to apprentices. We then had a workshop with our key stakeholders in transport to see how we can work together, and I'm pleased to report that as a result of those interactions, we now have a memorandum of understanding with the National Department of Transport, which has actually given us $6 million to train taxi drivers in preparation for World Cup 2010. The Northwest Department of Transport has also signed an MOU with us for us to see how we can cooperate with them in the training of the taxi industry. We also had an MOU with the SEDA, Small Enterprise Development Agency. They were assisting us when we were going around in provinces to just expose people on what opportunities are there for small businesses. We also have an MOU that we're signing and revising with SAMHSA, and we also have MOUs with other sectors just to cooperate better. The third challenge or the third constraint we have is our business processes that are quite cumbersome. What we have done, we have done an investigation or actually an analysis or an assessment. We currently have an IT system that is not necessarily the best out there in the market. I think our battery has gone flat, but because we've got copies of the slides, I can just go through. Sorry about that. In terms of cumbersome business problems, I have said our IT system is not the best that we have on the market. What we have done, we have assessed what we can do in order for us to come up with a system that works for everybody. Because we believe if you have everything done manually, it tends to become cumbersome and time consuming. So we have then come up with a tender for us to have an integrated IT program in place, and we are in the process of coming up with a system that we believe will benefit the transport sector as an organization and all of our clients that are coming to us for assistance. We are back on air. The other challenge that our stakeholders always really raise is that our timelines are very tight. But we have made it very clear, some timelines are not actually regulated by ourselves, they are regulated by our executive authority. Where we can't help it, we really can't help it. But where we can then try and see how we can meet them calmly. We have standardized our internal contract management guidelines so that there's consistency throughout the organization, and we've actually streamlined our mandatory grant policy in line with regulations, and we've actually gone a step further to look at our performance information management, which tends to be a nightmare in organizations, managing knowledge and managing data and making sure that the data that you have is quite credible to be able to provide wherever it is necessary. One of our last challenges is that most of the companies in the transport sector do not participate in TITA processes. just don't participate. People pay the 1% of their salary, the 1% of their salary bill to farm, and they take it as a tax. And that is it. They then don't go and make sure that they've got the WSP, which is a workplace skills plan. They don't go and demonstrate how they would implement that workplace skills plan at the end of the year with an annual training report. And when that happens, we get evaluated as a CETA that we are not getting many companies participating in our processes. Now, what we have done to try and improve the performance of companies in this process, which they regard as cumbersome, is for us to have newspaper adverts calling for SMEs to start participating in our processes. We also have seen an increase in the number of WSPs for the road passenger, road freight, and forwarding and clearing subsector. What we have also done to make life a bit easy was for us to change our mandatory grant policy because it had quite stringent grant criteria. We also then had a task team set internally to make sure that all staff are consistently involved in how to run projects and contracts better. And that is it. Somebody was very naughty there, assuming that the committee would step in. Thank you very much for the briefing that you have made to this committee with regards to the performance of the sector. I will now take the opportunity and give the members to interact with the presentation. Members, this is your opportunity. Honorable Sisters, followed by Mamele, then Honorable Lucas, then Honorable Paul.
Thanks for the presenter for the detailed presentation. Just a few questions from me. the presentation referred to mandatory grants. Can you just explain what that is? Because in my preparation for this meeting, I looked at the reading mass that I couldn't find what that actually means. So what is a mandatory grant, and what are the criteria for that? And also, you mentioned that mandatory grants were granted to large firms. What is the definition of a large firm and a medium firm? And then you also talked about discretionary grants. You could unpack that, what that is and what is the criteria. So I'm presuming that discretionary is some kind of criteria to create that discretion. And then also with regards to Abbott, you mentioned that over 1,000 people were supported in training with adult education. If you could explain what the support entails, does it just mean a monetary support, and what kind of support are we talking about? And then during the presentation as well, there was a list of NGOs, CBOs, etc. that you said you also supported. If you could explain how those are supported. And in each case, you could just tell us how monitoring and evaluation, if any, is done in this regard. Well, in other words, what you're supporting, are you making sure that certain outcomes are being met when you're supplying the support? And then what's interesting for me is that you trained, you supported, you said, a number of unemployed learners. Was there a way to measure to ensure that this unemployed person became employed as a result of this training? Is there a way of doing that? Or have you got a system that ensures or monitors this? And then you also mentioned that there was training or support, as you call it, for new ventures. Was there also a way of monitoring to make sure that new ventures were created in the first place once this took place? You also said you supported four institutions in particular. How were these institutions picked? Is there a criteria that is used, and can institutions apply, or do institutions apply? Is there a process in this regard? And Madam Chair, I think I've got one more, or just two more. Oh, you mentioned road shows as part of your marketing campaign. What form did these road shows take? And did you also have certain objectives to meet to make sure that you, not a matter of doing the road shows, but making sure there's a certain outcome in impact on these road shows. And then the last question I have is, you mentioned at the end that companies are basically paying their 1% levy and effectively not using the TICA. How are they being communicated to? In the sense I get is a lot of them don't even know that they can access have this facility. So is there a marketing or information dissemination campaign for these companies that are affected? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I must say the presentation was very good. Thank you very much. It is what you are doing, especially the lot of training that you are doing. But I must say, I understand the frustration that you have. But we keep on coming back to you and say, yes, maybe you are doing this, but we still don't know. I know you have visited a lot of avenues trying to expose yourself to us, but still, we don't see you. We don't know what is happening. Like, we have a lot of skilled people who are unemployed, who are sitting there with wonderful skills, and they don't know. Can't maybe, I won't say something better than you are doing, I mean, trying to let us know, but can't you do more? And I think you deal with provinces. I'm also from a province, quite a lot of us, everybody is from a province, but we don't, for instance, we had a meeting on Saturday. They were telling us about the bursaries, and they even said, you from Parliament, you give bursaries to white people and not us. We said that thing. That means they don't know. And what are we going to tell them? Because we also don't know. I feel something more must be done so that it should filtrate down to those people who are living there with skills. And secondly, you are training taxis and you say for 2010. It's a good thing, but it shouldn't be for 2010. Everybody knows our taxes. Really, being in a taxi business, the noise, no respect, whatever it is, I think all of them, I think you should continue even after 2010 to train these people. Go east, west, and south, they understand, they do the same thing. But if we have people like you, Tita, who are able to train them, why don't you continue training them? At least we have better taxi drivers. It's fun to go to a taxi, taking a taxi to town like this. Otherwise, I'm saying, please do more in exposing yourself to this training of ours. Thank you very much.
The expenditure, the financial performance, I see here that there was a total of 15%, and then admin is 94%, and then you get the mandatory grant of 70% and the discretionary grant of 71%. I'm just wondering why the admin is 94%, because I thought that it would be more uniform, because if you 94% at 1%, and the others are 70%, it doesn't show up. That's just a query. The other thing is that I was pleased to notice to hear when you talk about apprenticeships, because at one stage we were getting away from apprenticeships, we were going to learnership. And I think apprenticeships is a good thing. If we could get back to that, because you give it both, you give a complete training of a number of years, and I think that is it. I'm only concerned about drivers also, whether we are giving all the drivers the opportunity to be skilled. Even when we look at these long distance buses, accidents occurring. But then again, you must know the employers are also trying to shortcut the longer hours for the drivers. I think we should look at that closely. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Chair.
you are saying that you have orientated 500 SMMEs. My question would be, how much money was spent in this exercise and how many job opportunities were created out of this exercise? Question number two, I see that you are saying that you have a risk register. What I would want to know is, what are the findings of this register? Of this risk register, and again, what kind of risk have you uncovered? Again, on page 55, I see that there's been an alleged expenditure of about 3 million. What I want to know is who was responsible and what action has been taken. Thank you, Chair.
Board
must come up with a discretion to say, we need to support new venture creation and not ABET, or we need to support ABET and not new venture creation. So it really depends on how the CISA, looking at the WSPs that have been submitted and the training plans of the companies, for it to decide where to actually place the discretion. What informs the discretion is the budget and the service level agreement targets that are set for that organization. It tends to become very interesting with discretionary grants when companies get upset when they didn't get a discretionary grant, which makes it look like discretionary grants are not discretionary grants. But it is based on the discretion of the board, and it has to be based on the service level agreement that the CISA has, and it has to be based on the analysis of what that CISA needs to be able to achieve. With respect to ABET, what does the support entail? The support for ABET currently entails numeracy and literacy, and it is done according to level 1 up to level 4. So it's almost like a school program on level 1 up to level 4. The intention has been now to actually, in line with the changes, to actually use ABET as foundational training for people that have no access to any schooling, but who have a particular expertise in a specific sector. So the intention now is to move away from literacy and numeracy, but to actually zoom into foundational learning, almost like closing the gap between what a person has learned practically in the workplace and what the person requires in order for them to get certification. The support to NGOs, you asked a question about support to NGOs. Generally, the support we give to NGOs is training. We don't give any other support. They could say to us, we need training in how to access funding for SMEs, maybe for women. We then give training, and we then provide, we could even fund a seminar or a workshop or a training session for them to get exposure in a specific sector. What we currently do, the kind of support we do it in association with the South African, they call it South African Network of Women in Transport, where women are actually clustered according to the different subsectors of transport, and they can then access funding for maybe somebody to come and talk to them about business planning, how to access funding to get trucks or whatever the case might be. So it really depends on the specific requirements of a specific NGO. How do we monitor that people are supported? The way in which we monitor the training that takes place, we do it in two ways. When a company is given a discretionary grant, we sign a contract with them. And one of the contract obligations is that the company must give us report, they must give us proof that they've actually trained the learners. Number one, before we even pay them, they must show us that they are learners, that what I need, the signed contracts, and those learners are actually existent. Once that is done and the program takes place, we want attendance registers. Once the training has finished, we then get an external moderator to go and confirm to us that the training did take place before we pay the service provider. And we also do site visits. So sometimes I will send the staff to a company to come and check the records of the company, see the learners, see the attendance registers. And the final thing that gives us confirmation that the actual training did take place, we have what we call competency declaration. When they're finished, they need to be declared competent in one way or another. And the way in which we do it is we then certificate them and check if those learners have done what they were supposed to do, have they been trained, have they gotten their certificates, and in some instances we then have certification ceremonies. Is there a way to check if there is a change, especially from those learners that we have supported that are unemployed, whether they have been employed as a result of our training? Currently, the only way we can check it is through the processes that I have outlined, but we would like to actually extend it and come up with impact studies and tracer studies for us to know who are the learners we have supported. Have you supported them? Where are they? Did we train them for the sake of training, or did they eventually end up somewhere
in the marketplace. We're currently having a project to try and do impact assessment and tracer studies just to get to know the placement levels and where those learners are. There was a question about how do we support unemployed? You wanted to know about MDs, four institutions that we have supported. How did we support them? Was there a process? Yes, there was a process. There was actually a public call. We advertised that we needed institutions that could be regarded as centers of excellence. An advert went out, and there were briefing sessions in all provinces. And those companies that were willing to actually participate submitted applications. Most of them are currently being supported in learning programs, and they're actually doing qualification-specific training. Now, out of the institutions that did apply, four qualified according to the criteria that was set, and currently the support that they get is in terms of curriculum development and learning materials development for them to be able to roll out the program. For the roadshows, you wanted to know what form did they take. The roadshows that we had took a specific form. We would go to a province, we would actually start by orientating our stakeholders and the people that had attended on who we were, what we do, what our mandate is, and then for us to measure impact at every roadshow, we then had a questionnaire that was given out to the people, and it was based on that questionnaire that we were able to actually identify the gaps that I've outlined in my presentation. So we were then able to actually get a sense from the roadshow, from the people attending the roadshows, on how we could be benefiting them better. Currently, the roadshows that we have got different shapes and forms. There is a skills development unit that would have what they call a support session roadshow, and they would go and meet with skills development facilitators so that they can outline new policies and all sorts of things with them. That takes the form of actually capacitating the people on new policies. But in some instances, for example, with ETQA, when we want to accredit providers, we actually have support sessions with providers that are potential providers that want to be accredited by India, and the specific focus will be on accreditation. When I do take roadshows, like I did at the beginning of the year, I generally focus on how the organization is doing, how we are performing against our mandate, and actually expose people to what we are all about. And I must say, obviously, the need out there is greater than we can reach everyone. How do we communicate to people? Do we have a marketing strategy for the companies that are not participating? The current marketing strategy that we have is for the people that are on the implementation side, who are the practitioners and their executive officers. We then go to companies and actually advertise first, meet with the companies, and try to get the companies to start participating in our processes so that they don't regard this TITA process as just a tax or an obligation that they don't feel they want to get involved. The question about unemployed people, can we do more, especially in training people that they continue to be unemployed? I must say that the new Minister of Higher Education and Training has given us a mandate, and he has said to us, we need to respond to the key priorities of government. One of the responses we need to make is with respect to rural development. What are we doing in rural areas that we haven't been doing for a number of years? And in this regard, we then have proposals and projects that we are awaiting the board to approve when we have our last board meeting. One of the things that we intend to do is to focus on three things: placement of people after they've been trained in the workplace, for them to get workplace experience. The second thing is for us to actually go to rural areas and schools and expose the learners there to what we do. And actually we have to work closely with the FET colleges and the institutions of higher learning. So we're actually changing the focus of our strategy to focus on workplace experience, focusing on the rural areas, making our presence felt in areas we have never been felt. So, and I must say, it's something new and exciting. And with any new change, discussions and frustration in the organization. Training the safety drivers. Are we only focusing on 2010? No, we're not only focusing on 2010. But with the taxi drivers, because we have realized that the budget we have is not enough, we have very optimistic that it might not take 2 years, but it will take a while for us to get our training sector, I mean the taxi sector, to be at a professional level. But we are not giving up because we believe they are significant to us. And the comment about apprentices, you are right there. Apprentices are very important, and one of the priorities of the new Minister of Higher Education. There was a question about expenditure and job opportunities. Expenditure and job opportunities for SMEs. We say we have orientated 500 SMEs. What is the expenditure today, and what are the job opportunities? Well, I wish I had the figures with me, but I know that the expenditure, we have set aside 5 million, and out of that 5 million, I'm told we have spent about 2.7 of that million. And the way in which the orientation sessions were, we gave them an opportunity to interact with staff in order for them to be able to get tax clearance certificates. So we got a number of SMEs in one session or in one hall in different provinces. Those that were registered needed to make sure that they could then know how to get tax clearance certificates from SARS. Those that were registered and had tax clearance certificates then could be exposed to how to do business plans, and that's why we had feeder in those orientation sessions, so that they can then be able to know how to write their business plans for them to be able to do something. Is it enough? Can we confirm that there are job opportunities arising out of there? We haven't yet done an assessment today to see if people have received far much more job opportunities than could be. But it is our intention to see what the impact of that orientation has been. There was a question with regards to the risk register. What has the risk register identified? I would give this one to the CFO. It would be very unfair for him to travel all the way from Pretoria without saying anything. So I'll give him an opportunity to really say what are the issues on the risk register. The issue on irregular expenditure, who was responsible for what happened? There were a number of reasons for that irregular expenditure. There were tenders that were split by a tender adjudication committee, and it was a committee that decided to do something that was not right in terms of the supply chain procedures. And the person that was found to have actually deviated on their duty was the procurement officer who was dismissed from the organization, and the CFO was also, he terminated his contract with Transport Center. So we have actually taken action against that, but we must emphasize that we have then notified National Treasury of that irregular expenditure, and we've sought to make sure that something like that does not ever happen again. I'll give over to the CFO for the
report. Thank you. The risk identification process, I think we just need to note that first of all, we do it with or being assisted by a reputable firm of internal auditors, and the risk identification process takes the form of they're broken down to strategic risks. These are the risks relating to the board, the governance issues, whether the board is is knows the provisions of King 3, how do they exercise or how do they execute their fiduciary duties. Also, it's broken down to operational risks, the risks in the different sort of departments within TITA, including finance, things like do we do our recons sort of on time, are there financial statements, that do we have supporting documentation, and all of those things. The risk identification process is really an ongoing process, because you find that they identify risks, and then we have the necessary internal control to address the risks. The internal auditors come to audit those risks, and then if they find that our internal controls are sufficient, then the other risks that were not audited will then be audited. Yes. The internal auditors report to the audit committee, which is obviously a subcommittee of the board and has the overall oversight of the risk of the whole risk management process. There was a question about the percentages in the financial statement. If I could just quickly explain that, when we say 94% in the administration reserve, is how much we have spent on the administration versus how much we have received on the administration. So it's essentially the 39 versus the 41. On the mandatory grant, same thing, it's the 144 over the 207, and on the discretionary, the 78 over the 109. Our revenue, as the CEO has explained, we receive it broken down into three categories: administration, mandatory, and discretionary. And therefore, when we report, we always try to report in those three categories as well. I'm not sure if I answered the question. Okay.
There was one question, Chairperson, if I'm not touched. We feel very strong that it must be clarified as well. The accidents that have been caused by the heavy vehicles, in particular the buses, the 2012. We want to respond and indicate that all the drivers in the transport sector, from the taxis to the buses, trucks, and all the mode of transport they are driving, have been categorized as a professional driver, which means that they are different from the other ordinary drivers on the road, because they can carry passengers, carry goods with safety, no damage, and no losses. That's why they are being categorized. And they are being trained at best to get that standard as well. But accidents are not caused by the human error only. That is a conclusion problem. There are many factors that are contributing to the accident on the road, with some of them are totally out of the authority, which is Utica. For instance, the conditions of employment, the conditions of the roads, the mulattoes of the wearers, and the Eastern Cape Road, the Mpumalanga Road. Utica has no control over the infrastructure, the roads, and so forth, which may cause the accident, which is the fact that most of the time they are contributing as well. But on site of the training of people that indeed they are professional drivers, that's where then it is in control and they are doing that as well. People are having the certificate, either than the driving license, that indeed they are professional drivers.
Members, any follow-up questions on responses that have been provided? Honorable Malulek.
Mine is just an addition to another question was answered. This is a question from a supervisor on unemployed people who they can do training. Just asking, how many people benefited from this? How many unemployed people? And there's this 200 million grants. I just want to know what exactly happened to investment, it was subsequently found
prosecuting authority that in the financial services board that the Fidelity Asset Management, the people that were managing the fund were not using the funds for which they were made. And as a result, the investments were lost. What is currently happening is that the matter is under the hands of the National Prosecuting Authority because criminal charges were laid, and it is a matter that is with the court. And there were curators that were appointed to try and recover and recoup the losses. They are also still in process of recouping the losses on behalf of the organizations that have invested significant amounts in that fund. The question with regard to unemployed people, how many have benefited? For the year under review, the learners that are unemployed that benefited from support is 1,402 learners throughout the country. So in total, it is 1,400. Our presence in provinces, what impact does it have? Our indirect presence in provinces. Currently, we believe going forward, if we were to strategize and be given an opportunity to continue beyond the NSDS2, we would really have to do a rethink on having presence in provinces, not indirectly, but directly, either by working with the Department of Labor or the Labor Offices or the Department of Transport or even the Department of Higher Education and Training. What we intend to do is to appoint what we call General Education and Training Practitioners that can, pending our budget availability, be able maybe to cover provinces like Limpopo, Northwest, Northern Cape, Free State, and those provinces that we believe currently we don't have a presence. So it is part of our strategy to try and see this indirect presence is not necessarily making our presence felt all the time, as we would wish, and we would want to really change the strategy and be deploying staff to those regions that we currently are not deployed. What we're currently doing for the Eastern Cape is that there is a general education and training practitioner who's based here, who covers the Cape, Western Cape and Eastern Cape, and a bit of Free State. And we also have another general practitioner that covers KZN and a little bit of Mpumalanga and all those provinces that are closer. But it is not, I must honestly admit that it is not working out as we would want it to work out.
Do you want to make any comment?
Okay.
Can I make a comment, Mr. Petty?
Okay.
I must say I'm very happy about your priority, making rural areas your priority. You don't know how much talent you are missing from the FET colleges that have come in rural areas, in so much that now the standard of those FET colleges have gone down because we proved them useless. Students go there and after completing, they don't do it, they join the unemployed. You say, I'm happy, really. I hope it works.
Members, any questions? Okay, comment from...
I think there was a very good talk about professional drivers and practices. Why doesn't this flow over to the taxi and make taxi drivers professional drivers?
Can also, maybe you can also indicate to us in your report you talk about the sandwich offices that you have in various provinces. Can you indicate in which provinces do you have these sandwich offices. While I was carrying through your report, there are lots of spelling errors. I don't know whether we have the quality assurance team to go through your report, because really this report is a public document. If there are lots of spelling errors, it just dents the image of this entity. Do we have a team that is looking at our documents before our documents are going out? Then the other one, you indicated that there's a memorandum of understanding with the transport department in Northwest, so that you can be able, you talk of 6 million if I'm not mistaken, you can be able to train more taxi drivers, which is addressing your budget constraints on the other side. What about the other provinces? What plans do you have to engage other provinces to do the same as the Northwest, so that you cover the large number of taxi drivers with regards to your training? And maybe give us some highlights on the number of taxi drivers that you have trained so far from 2005, as well given some highlights with other activities that you have done from 2005 to date. How many taxi drivers have you been able to?
Thank you very much. I think I need to indicate, in terms of the taxi industry, earlier on in the presentation, the CEO indicated the fact that it was 8 chambers within TITA, and one of those chambers is the taxi chamber. Now, one very unique characteristic about the taxi chamber is that it has got one of the largest number of operators within the industry, within the chambers that Tita has. I think around 150,000 to 180,000 operators. Yet it is the lowest levy generating chamber within Tita. If I can give an example, I think for this year we got something like 120,000 or 180,000 rand worth of levy from the taxi industry, compared to something like 15, 18, 10 million from the other chambers. Now that in itself creates quite a very serious challenge, because half of the mandatory grant, and then what remains would be very little, around 50,000 rand, which basically now be shared among the industry to undertake other skill development programs, which is very, very, very little. Now I just wanted to indicate this, that it's a very serious challenge that we're experiencing with the chamber at the moment. Now the other thing that we do therefore is to leave an opportunity for us to enter into collaborative efforts with other government supported institutions or departments to actually get money elsewhere to direct towards the skill development programs within the taxi industry. Now I just want to give you a background in terms of what has happened in the past in terms of the interventions made within the industry. 205.06 provides that geographic spread and distribution in terms of the number of people trained in each and every province within the industry. Mpumalanga, Free State, Northwest, Limpopo, 425, Western Cape, 245, and the total is 3,048. And then the following financial year, we also provide that breakdown, and the total there is 880. The current professional driver skills program that is ongoing, that the CEO referred to, has got that equitable distribution in terms of the number of taxi drivers trained in each and every province. As the CEO indicated, the focus is on the 2010. However, it even goes beyond that, because as one of the honorable members indicated, we want to create an industry that is going to be responsive to the needs of our people, which is going to contribute, you know, viably to the growth of the industry as well as the economy. And of course, we're also touching on other soft skills kind of training, like, for instance, taxi behavior, the management, life skills issues, and all that, to ensure that really we have people within the industry that can be encouraged and attracted to really go and you know, ride in those particular taxis. So I think in total, we've got a figure of 4,198 people who, by the end of the current financial year, from 2005, would have been trained within the industry. But we really feel, I've indicated that there are around 180,000 taxi operators within the country, and those are the registered ones. We are told there's another number that may not be registered and which we may not know of. So it really shows that it's a very, very, very small drop in the ocean in terms of the mammoth work that we are faced with to really improve the industry. Thank you.
Any comments? Maybe also you can clarify the issue of the termination for administration. Just for the committee to have the view of how many employees are you supposed to have according to the staff establishment, you know, how many posts are we able to also the vacancy rate, and the impact of that vacancy rate in the operation of your, in the execution of your money. The greatest challenge for us is with respect
budget that is actually available for us to be able to fulfill our mandate. And I believe the committee could really play a significant role in assisting by ensuring that currently I believe that government agencies that report to the Transport Department would be better cooperating with us if they understood that their mandate was actually especially put a certain amount aside for skills development. So I believe we could really get a lot of assistance in working farmers better with the entities that report to government Department of Transport. Currently, we work very closely with the department itself and some agencies that are sitting in a few other chambers do participate, but I believe if that participation could be done in a coherent, cohesive way, it definitely do far much better because we wouldn't be taking efforts. The biggest challenge for us really is about the taxi industry. The taxi industry doesn't pay levies like we need. They don't pay levies as other sectors do. And that tends to become a problem when they have to be supported in terms of trading. And I believe they could really do us much better if we could work closely with the taxi industry. Whether the committee would be able to work to get Santaco, which is their actual committee that has to work with us, work better, I'm not sure. But when it comes to our current, I spoke about the 10%, the current staff complement I have are about 67 staff members. And out of those 67 staff members, about 10 of them are contract staff that are contracted for a specific period. And obviously, the legislation was set up and the funding framework was set up such that it was decided that 10% of our income must go towards admin expenses. But clearly, I believe that that magic number doesn't necessarily work out when you get into a real institution. And given the complexities of our sector, that 10% is not working out. To a point that I must say, we have actually found ways in which we can get more staff by trying to take 10% project expenses from the specific project so that we can then appoint people based on the specific projects that they are appointing, but it is not always, it doesn't give you continuity. Now, we have actually costed our service level agreement with the Department of Labor, and that service level agreement, when we costed it, we realized that unless we cut to the extreme some intervention, we wouldn't be able to fulfill our targets for the next year. For example, we are currently implementing the 09-010 service level agreement. And as you would all know, we are in an economic recession and we have seen a reduction of about 3% in our levies that we get from companies. The ripple effect of that reduction is we would then be unable to fulfill some of our targets and some of our mandates, and that doesn't augur well. And when you look even at our admin expenses, we have had to go back and minus 3% out of our projected admin expenditure just to make sure that we stick within the 10%. And the 10% tends to be an albatross on one's neck if you look at the figure that has been decided. But it is actually a legal thing that clearly the Department of Higher Education would have to look at in terms of their new funding framework to see if that 10% actually works out when you have to look at funding and resources. So when we costed our annual strategy and we costed what we have, we realized that we have to do some cuts, and those cuts have had an impact on the staff. If we were to look at our strategic plan and look at how much we need in terms of resources, we clearly fall back in terms of what we are supposed to do. But we're trying to make do with what we have, and up until there is a decision taken on how the funding of CTAS is going to be going forward, we will just have to stick within our budget. But I believe the committee could really play a very critical role in, we do not mind staying within a percentage decided, but let that percentage be realistic and let that percentage be based on the complexity of the sector. Because clearly, if you compare CTAS, they do different things in different sectors. In some sectors like ours, it's costly
but I would think a one-size-fits-all service level agreement is not really ideal. A one-size-fits-all funding framework is not necessarily ideal, but it would really help if the funding framework would allow for some flexibility in order for us to implement the mandate that we currently have.
Thank you very much, CEO, for responding and also for some of the officials for asking members to have detailed information with regard to the issues that have been raised for this meeting. But challenges will not remain challenges forever. There should be solutions for those challenges that we have identified, hoping that the Justice Committee will try our best to assist or to intervene with. So, without the waste of time, members, I think we're done with Chita. Let me thank the CEO and her entourage for being part of this meeting so that I can be able to attend the other meeting of the Committee on Labour. And I would suggest that we have a 5-minute discussion and then come back and continue with the President's Fund. Thank you very much.
Can I then take this opportunity and give you the role of the President's Fund to their program, specifically about their annual report, because we were aware that we met on the 1st of September. We got the briefing from the Road Accident Fund, since this was a new committee for the Road Accident Fund, to make some highlights of their program for activities. We have also identified their challenges that they are experiencing as an entity, but today the focus is on the annual report. 2008-2009, because as a committee we have to comply that it's in every financial year. After 6 months, after the end of the financial year, we have to engage the entity on its performance so that we can check or say the committee whether the budget that has been allocated to the entity, whether there was value for money. If not, what were the challenges? Then can I then take this opportunity and give it to Mr. Madise, the CEO of the Road Accident Fund, to just bring us. Thank you.
Honorable Chairperson, thank you for this opportunity again. As it correctly states, when we came out here on the 1st of September, we went through, I know we've repeated a copy of the presentation, you'll see one of the items that we had on the slide was a review of our performance for the financial year 2009. So we've already gone through the bulk of the financial statement. So what we're going to do today is, rather than do it through slide presentation, I'm going to just run the committee through the annual report itself. Some of the information will probably be a little bit more repetitive, but I think it will go a little bit more in detail on where we are and some of the aspects that we haven't covered on the 1st of September. So once again, we have covered some of this ground. So today it will be more just to highlight different areas and that sort of thing. Can I then ask committee members to help use the annual report itself, because I'm going to be taking the committee through the annual report itself. And I'm hoping everybody has got a copy of the annual report. And because I'm going to be jumping around, what I'll do is I'll be referring to the pages at the bottom of the annual report. The pages are really stated at the bottom left-hand edge of the reports themselves. So that's how we're going to go through the annual report rather than through the presentation. Now, perhaps we start off on the annual report, and maybe if we start on right on the cover page itself, just to remind the committee what our business is all about, we describe it in the second letter profile. So our business is to provide really compulsory cover to all road users in South Africa, resident and foreigners. And you'll see elements of payments that we make to foreigners in our annual report. So anybody who finds themselves on South African roads and they get involved in an accident, they are covered. And our socio-economic role is again stated on the, in the profile there. Our business is to reintegrate victims of road accidents back into society from a health and economic perspective, but also to protect wrongdoers and the families from financial ruin. You'll see when you go through the numbers that, in fact, if you look at our role, we actually should be spending a lot more money on medical costs and perhaps areas like loss of income. And you'll see when you look at the numbers whether we are actually achieving our socio-economic role or not. So that's just by way of introduction. Our vision and mission hasn't changed. That's on page one of the annual report. The one area to just bring the committee's attention to is that we actually would like to obviously get involved in accident prevention because we believe that it's an area that will allow us to stop claims from happening. And we have sufficient data to indicate where some of the problem areas are and this. So that's just by way of background. Now, can I jump? We've got flats on the side of the annual report itself. If I can perhaps jump to the section that says report, the annual financial statement, that's on section 9. We go to section 9 and perhaps we start with page 97. Section 9, page 97 of the annual report. On page 97, we have a report of the Auditor General. And what the Auditor General does, they indicate some of the responsibilities and the work that they've done during the year. But if you take to page 98, you will notice that under item 7 there, that they have once again issued an unqualified audit opinion. That's on note number 7. So the AG once again has issued an unqualified audit opinion. However, they do raise certain areas of emphasis, and beginning with 8 and 9. Number 8 is just a standard a reference to the fact that we are using GRAP as opposed to GAP. GRAP is a general, well, it's actually accounting statement that National Treasury requires state-owned entities to use. So you're going to find these sort of qualifications in all the, not qualifications, emphasis of matter in all the state-owned entities. The one area, though, that they do raise is on item number 9. And it's an area that we've highlighted to this committee, that our total liabilities exceeds our total assets by 39 billion. Right. So they do reflect on the fact that we are technically insolvent, and they indicate in the second paragraph there some of the areas that are contributing to this. And the largest area being the provision for outstanding claims. We'll go through in the details on how the actuaries arrive at that provision for outstanding claims. Which it's grown substantially in the current financial year. But they also highlight a second item, which is the fact that we keep on processing more claims than we receive fuel levy income. We've been, I think, a victim of our own successes. So as we improve operational efficiencies and this, we've actually developed an ability to process a little bit more claims than the cash they receive in fuel levy income allows. So, we always have to go and slow down the processing of claims when you run out of cash. And you'll see when we look at the numbers later that we did run out of cash during this financial year, the one year ending 2009. And in fact, National Treasury had to advance us an additional 2.5 billion rand. Those numbers will come in at a later stage. So it is an issue that the AG is still concerned about. But I think you'll also see that it has another effect, which is item on the same page, item number 10 there, that for as long as we slow down the processing of claims, because we operate in a litigated space, that we always have sheriffs coming to us and interest on amounts that we don't pay. So to the extent that we're not paying on time, and I think the hostile legal fraternity goes and issues writs and that sort of thing, you'll see that there's a figure of around 15 million, 14.997 on item number 10 there, that the AG brings attention to, which they still classify as fruitless and wasteful expenditure, but you know, in reality, it's not always within our control, especially when we run out of cash. So those are the two, I think, main areas where the AG brings the attention of, I think, of the reader's financial statements to. But as it relates to how the administration works, on page 99, you'll see the table there. There's a lot of positive ticks on a lot of areas. The one area where there has been adjustment in our financial statement in item number 2 there, because every year we have to go and do evaluation of our spending liabilities, and it's such a big number. You know, we go through it in detail. So invariably, when we submit our financial statement, this number is the one number that changes after year end. So so where they say the financial statements were not subject to material amendments, there's always that one material amendment relating to the provision for spending claims. But other than that, you know, we submit the financial statements in fact 30 days after year end, long before the statutory requirements. And on the control environment, you'll see that they're pretty satisfied. And that's on page 99 and page 100 there. They also satisfy that even on any areas of audit that they refer to, that we follow up appropriately. And last block on page 100, on performance information, that we have appropriate systems to allow us to do this. So it's a clean audit opinion. They have also audited over the performance information, which we're going to go through now. And their opinion on the performance information is on page 101. At this point in time, the AG doesn't obviously have to express an opinion. They just indicate whether they're satisfied that the performance information, no material significant items have been found. So paragraph 18 on page 101, the AG indicates that based on the evidence that they've obtained, they're obviously quite satisfied that no significant findings have been identified. So in terms of the public audit, they're not required to do this yet. So that's by way of introduction in terms of what our house looks like. If I perhaps, before we go through the numbers themselves and jump to the performance information, you will see that this is under section 5. If you go to section 5 of your annual report and you start on page 48, you see on that page, annually, what the Road Accident Fund does is we enter into an agreement with the minister relating to performance on a number of areas. And we enter into a shareholder compact plus a performance agreement. So you'll see that it contains some hard targets, plus some targets relating to obviously social objectives and that sort of thing. Now, if you go through some of those targets on that page, you'll note that there's actually one that hasn't been achieved, and we'll go through it and indicate what it is. And in fact, it's the first one, the one that says accumulated deficit. At the end of March 2009, must be less than the targeted amount. So that's 38,609 billion. This is what a sort of a deficit should have been. But in reality, it ended up being 40.043 billion. So that's the one target that hasn't been achieved. Now, you'll see later on, and in fact, I'm going to jump to the section now, although we'll deal with it in a bit more detail. One of the primary reasons why the absolvency wasn't achieved this year is because the provision for spending liability increased by around 12 billion this year. And in increasing by 12 billion, one of the factors that caused the increase was that the actuary changed the basis of valuing this liability. And if I take you to the page where they indicate how the liability has changed from last year to this year, if you go to page 140, if you go to page 140 of the annual report, there's a little table on page 140. Page 140 is at the bottom. If you go to page 140 of the annual report, you'll see that what the actuaries do is they provide a sort of description of what has caused some of the movement in the provision for spending plan. So they start with a figure of 30.3 billion at the beginning of the financial year, and then they indicate the provision that has increased in respect of claims in the current financial year, 12 billion. And then what we paid about 11 billion this year. And there's an unwinding of interest, but there's also an impact of 8.5 billion on what we call change in basis. I think actually this is a very complex area that actuaries have to deal with. And all the time they change the basis of valuation and that. So in reality, if you remove the 8.5 billion change in basis, you'll see that target, in fact, would have been achieved. So if you go back to the performance target on page 49 there, you'll see that the outstanding, on page 48, you'll see that that accumulated deficit of 40 billion, if you do adjust for the 8.5 billion, the changes in basis, that target, our actual figure would have been around 31 billion. So we would have achieved the target. But other than that, some of the hard financial targets related to our liquidity, and you'll see on the actual side, if we ended up with cash holdings of 1 billion rand compared to breaking even in the previous financial year. Our cost of administration, we've reduced, our target was about 40%, we've reduced it to 38%. Once again, this is, you'll see when you look at the numbers again in detail, that this, in our mind, is a stretch, still a stretch on the surface, because in reality, our scheme is still substantially wasteful. We're still paying 2.5 billion in legal costs, and until we change fundamentally the scheme that we are administering, the cost of compensation ratio will still remain high. But that aspect is achieved. I won't go through all of them. I think some of them we are supposed to go work out the revenue requirement model that we have done. And if you then go to page 49, I'll just perhaps jump onto one of a few of them. We've worked with the Department of Transport on Norfolk, and some work will probably be coming to this committee soon. Our HR costs, well, admin and HR costs as a percentage of fuel levy income, you'll see that we came in lower. There's some systems and processes where we've also introduced SAP, and if you go to page 50, claims solution as well, we finalized the design, and just above item 2 there, you'll see that we also had targets relating to claims processing, and we are supposed to process 257,000 claims. We actually processed 330,000, so that was also achieved. And now some of the social objectives, like BEE, amount we spend on BEE, especially discretionary spending, we're spending over 44% of our discretionary income on like economic empowerment. And item 4 there on page 50, you'll notice that we actually, I think, almost exemplary in terms of employment equity, because in terms of the where we are, gender and race representation, we're really right up there, because we have 87% in terms of employment equity. We do obviously spend quite a bit on training. That's on page 51. Our target was at least 1% of our total staff costs. We have spent 2.4%, and we actually have increased the number of disabled people that are employed within the RES. And we've got a staff complement of round figure 2,000, and in fact the real figure is 1953. And already just under 2% of it are people with disabilities. So those are some of the areas that we focus on. And corporate social investment and preparation for FIFA World Cup. So by and large, the targets that we set as a board with our shareholder, which consists of both hard targets and I think social targets, have been achieved. And the one that hasn't been achieved, and we'll see later, I think primarily arises out of the valuation of outstanding liabilities. So that's the second aspect that I thought we should. So if we maybe jump back to the annual report section on section 9, and then if I just to remind the committee of our numbers just for the current financial year, I'll start with the statement of financial performance on page 110. On page 110. And the way I'm going to do this is also, you'll see on the face of the financial statement, there's a column called notes. That column that's called notes, it's got details of each one of those aspects. So when necessary, I'll probably jump to the details and indicate where some of the details are. So on our revenue side, you'll see that our total revenues were, in fact, close to 11.9 billion. That's right at the bottom of the first block there. 11.9 billion compared to 8.4 billion in the previous financial year. Now, the bulk of it, if you go back up, where the column that says net fuel levy, we received 8.8 billion in fuel levy income compared to 8.2 billion last year. But we also received transfer from National Treasury of 2.5 billion. So all our transfer receipts totaled 11.3 billion. But in addition to this, we also, because we keep cash, we have some cash holdings, we've also received some investment income of about 103 million. The bulk of it is interest income that we get from any cash holdings that we have. And the only reason it dropped is because of changes in the interest rate and the fact that we actually had less cash during the year. As I said, we ran out of cash for about 5 months of the year. Other revenues is made primarily of foreign exchange gains. If you remember our business, we also cover foreigners. And most of the foreign exchange gain was, in fact, when we're paying one of the largest claims we've ever paid, which we paid during the year, the $500 million. The $500 million, that's actually €42 million to Schorsch. We had a small foreign exchange gain. We typically, as soon as we finalize the claim, we take forward cover. And depending on what happens to exchange rate at the time that you do your final settlement, you get either a gain or a loss. But it's not something that we might you should expect to see as a regular income, because the forex can always go the other way. And there's you'll see there's a huge increase in reinsurance revenue. The 452 million compared to 2.3 million in the previous financial year. Most of that income arises out of the amount that they pay to us by the Lloyd's, the London market, when we settle the short claim. And just to explain this again, we have a we take cover with the reinsurance market for large claims. The way the cover works is that RAF pays the first $100 million, the first $100 million of any claim, individual claim that is a large claim, we will pay as the RAF as well. And then the bulk of it, the balance above $100 million, we have shipped out to reinsurers who are based in London, and obviously AIG is also in the US. So AIG picks up an amount up to $300 million, and then any amount above that is taken by a few reinsurance companies. So when we settled short, the reinsurers obviously came to the party. Although primarily we make the payment ourselves, the reinsurers do pay the balance of the amount. So, and again, don't expect to see that amount next year. It depends on how much we recover from the reinsurance market. So that's the 452 million. So that's the bulk of our income. If you look at our expenses, you'll see that claims expenditure looks like it's gone way high from 15 billion to about 23 billion. But here, let me take you to note 20, because I think the detail on note 20 will explain this a little bit better. Note 20 is on page 151. Note 20 is on page 151. And therein lies the breakdown of how much we paid. So of the total claims expenditure, we have paid 11.1 billion cash for claims. 11.1 billion compared to 8.7 billion last year. And 12 billion is just the increase in the provision from last year to this year. So when the AG says that we pay more than we receive money, you know, I think as an entity, we've been trying to focus on service delivery and ensuring that most of the accident victims get paid as soon as possible. Unfortunately, we've been limited by the cash flows that we get in fuel levy income. So that 11.1 billion could have been higher had the fuel price been set at the right level to allow us to process the entire backlog of claims. So cash that we paid out is 11 billion. By the way, that 276 million is claims that we have processed before year end, but that we haven't paid, at year end. So that's the reason why our claims expenditure has gone up. the reinsurance premium, what I had said earlier, that the reinsurance market covers our big losses. The premium that we pay is around 23.7 million. So I think it's a very cost-effective premium. If you think about the fact that the reinsurers paid close to, over just under 500 million, and for a premium of 23 million each year, it's still a bargain. We'll look later on staff costs. In fact, if you go to page 22, note 22, which is on the same page 151, you'll see that our staff complement didn't increase by much on page 151. At year end, we had 1953 staff members, with a little note at the bottom, from 1810 in the previous financial year. We'll go through some of the detail later on and why, on average, despite the fact that our complement has been increased, that our staff cost increased marginally higher than we wanted. In fact, perhaps let me just explain it now, is that because we spent 5 months in the year slowing down processing of claims, for us to get on track in terms of where we needed to be in the backlog of claims, we've actually had to get staff working a little bit of overtime. And that's primarily one of the reasons why staff costs have increased slightly higher than we would have liked for it to increase. And administration costs, we will also look at it a little later and describe what they are. Okay, perhaps if you go to page 152, you'll see that the bulk of our admin costs are really, standard costs. We explain the other expenses and don't bulk at the fact that our professional fees look like the higher. We're going through a process where we're just about to roll out the new claims administration solution. So what we've been spending money on is on infrastructure. So part of that 46 million is around 12 million that we've been invested on modernizing our infrastructure, basically IT infrastructure and SAP. Around 9 million of it is SAP, and 8 million of it is the claims administration solution that we introduced. But you'll also notice that we've also had an amendment act that came in during the year. So one of the provisions of the Amendment Act, it requires doctors throughout the country to be retrained on AMA guides. This is a guide that we use to determine how seriously injured accident victims are, because now we have a limitation that says that you can only claim serious injury. You can only claim general damages if you are seriously injured. So we had to do quite a lot of training of doctors throughout the country on the new AMA guide and that. So that's by and large where we spend some of the money on. And areas like subsistence and transport, you'll see that we're expanding our network. You'll see in the cover there that we're now operating from hospitals and those sort of areas. So we're wanting to cover as much of the country as we can. So that's basically what's been driving, I think, the bulk of the admin costs. If you go back to the face of the Statement of Financial Performance on page 110, you'll see that although we show a deficit of 12 billion in the current financial year, in reality, the bulk of it arises out of the fact that our provision has increased this year compared to last year. If I just take you back to page 109, the balance sheet, just to indicate where we are on our financial position. On page 109,
we're sitting with cash of $1 billion. We were sitting with cash of $1 billion at year end. 1.9 billion is what was owed by SARS to us because they're doing the collection of our income for us. And the interest receivable is small. Those other receivables, I think, in the context of our balance sheet, the 79 million, is relatively small. So we won't go through it in detail. But the details are obviously on note 7. Note 7 is on page, or we can say it, just quickly look at it on page 131. Other receivables on page 131. You'll see that the bulk of the cash, 58 million of that money, is actually REF's own money that we put aside for director's indemnity policy. So it's cash that we put in an insurance company as director's indemnity policy. And the balance of it, 17 million, is, you know, a legal claim that we have with Alexander Forbes, you know, who've been owing us money because they had been given money in the past. So most of the cash is basically director's liability cover. If you go back to page 109, they have the big items, property, plant, and equipment on that page. That's really our real physical asset other than cash. And that's a building that we own in Menlyn. We do an annual revaluation of the building. The rest of the assets, like motor vehicles and those sort of things, are pretty small. Now, that balance sheet or the statement of financial position indicates that our total assets are only 3.2 billion. Now, what is obviously of concern is when you compare the total assets of 3.2 billion with our liabilities of 43.2 billion, I think you'll see that that's where the insolvency of the REF comes in, and the bulk of it is just provision for outstanding claims. So if you quickly go down that balance sheet, you'll see most of the items are small, payables and accruals. It's, you know, primarily that 428 million is primarily claims that we processed that we're gonna pay in the following year. Unutilized government grants, you'll see that most of the 2.5 billion that we received from government we've already used by year end to process claims. So we've actually used the bulk of that of the government grant. The two large items, that's provision for outstanding claims. It's split between two. The current portion is 9.2 billion, and the long-term portion is 33 billion. So in total, it amounts to 42 billion. And perhaps because it's such a significant item, if you go to note 13. It will indicate how the actuaries arrived at this figure. And note 13 is on page 136. Note 13 is on page 136. So you see on page 136 that this is by far our biggest liability on our financial statement. That's 42 billion, 42.5 billion compared to 30 billion last year. What the actuaries do, and in fact there is a comment about the second paragraph below the figures at the top there, you'll see that 42 billion is a discounted liability. That means this is in today's money terms. In reality, when we pay every single cent, the nominal amount will be 63.8 billion. So the actuaries do this clever mathematics and they say, what is the present value of this liability? So what they do is they, if we pay it over the period of time that it takes us to pay, the physical rents and cents that will go out is 63 billion. Although that 63 billion is worth 42 billion this year. And this shows the extent of the hole that I think we're sitting in as a country. Because of the scheme that we are operating. I mean, this is a scheme that really has got largesse and exceptionally generous that you actually do not find anywhere else in the world in this form, and it creating this sort of hole in I think in government coffers. So that's the liability. We won't go through the technicalities of how they do it. You'll see on page 137, they indicate at the top, the first bullet point, that they use methods they call chain-ladder method. I don't think it's probably necessary to look at it now. On the table, that's on page 137 there, this is non-undertaking. What they indicate is what we ultimately pay in liability for each accident year. So if you pick up any year, you know, say 2007, you'll see that for all accidents that happened in 2007, we'll probably pay about 10.6 billion. And then these figures have been increasing as we go down. If you go to page 138, I think you'll see that the bulk of the increase in the current year, the bulk of the increase relates to current year. And the table right at the bottom describes exactly how our business actually works. The blue portion is future payment. So whenever an accident happens, it takes on average a couple of months and often years before claimants report the accidents to us. So what often happens is that, for instance, if you look at the column that says 2009 at the bottom there, you'll see that the green is what we typically pay in cash. The blue is what we're going to pay in the future. So because it takes around, well, our law allows any accident victim up to, say, well, between 3 to majority, which is 21 or is it 18 now, 21 years to lodge a claim. So if you're a minor, you can get involved in an accident now and wait 18 years before you lodge a claim, or 21 years. So prescription only happens if you're not a minor and you're a major, so an adult, you have up to 3 years to lodge a claim. So we don't always get newer claims right at the beginning. So you will see that most of the payment that you're making on any particular year relates to prior years. And that's why the provision becomes so significant, because what the actuaries are saying is that what you're going to pay in future years relating to accidents that are happening this year is a big portion, and that's the blue portion at the top there. We've already gone into page to page 140. We've already gone into some of the reasons why the provision has increased this year compared to last year. But what is interesting is the graph on page 141 that indicates that included in that provision for selling liability is still a big portion relating to general damages. This is the graph on page 141. General damages are still a significant portion of our future payments. So although we go and the new Amendment Act has set limits on general damages, and in fact it's dropped about 25% compared to the previous year because of partly because of the Amendment Act, there is still general damages are still a big portion of what we're going to pay in the future. So that's indicated on that page. So that just gives you a sense of our numbers. We'll go through just operational performance in a little while. But the important thing to note, though, is two things. We are paying more in claims than we receive in field levy income. Our field levy income is still set at a level that is much, much lower than what we require to run our business. And we have shared a model with National Treasury that allows us to correct this, but they haven't applied it fully. And it's an area that we want to concentrate on. And we shared with this committee when we were here in September how the model works and this sort of area. And by the way, that model is also intended to resolve our solvency issues. And our solvency issues, the fact that we're sitting with a deficit of 39 billion, and let us say 40 billion, it's a hole that the government is sitting with that we need to address. I think, in the future. And the fuel levy, the model is designed to do just that. If I just then jump to the front portion of our annual report, and perhaps focus on, you know, some of the operational performances, and starting first with the cover. I think one of the things you will notice, though, is that we've begun to expand our geographic footprint. We're going to undertake this over a couple of years. You know, there was no reason why RAF didn't have offices, say, in Kokstad or Tzaneen or Lydenburg, because accidents do happen there. But the manner in which we're expanding this footprint is by first getting representation at hospital points. We're now sitting with 43, at the table at the top of that footprint there, we're sitting with 43 hospital points. Over the next 5 years, we want to go all the way to around 128 hospital points. We're going to have mobile service points and retail service points, and some of these, it's not going to be our own infrastructure. We're going to obviously piggyback on other service providers, which we still need to negotiate with, like the post offices and all those sort of people. The idea being that we want South Africans to be able to access our services where they live. It doesn't make sense that somebody who, you know, who lives in Tzaneen has to drive all the way to Pretoria just to lodge a claim. And it affects the poor the most because of the traveling costs and that. So that's the area that we're looking at. And you'll see that we're actually changing our model. We're now translating our claim form in all 11 languages. So we have a language policy that we're now introducing. We'll also roll out as we roll this out. This will enable claimants to obviously claim in their own languages and that. So that's one of the areas that we're going to be focusing on in the coming years. The second aspect, road safety, we've gone through at the when we heard the last time. It just gives context to our business. And what is interesting, though, is some of the trends that you see in the block, those graphs on the right-hand side, that, in fact, you know, RTMC seems to indicate that fatalities are dropping, but we're not seeing any decrease in the number of accidents reported to us. There is a ratio of 1 to 20 in the number of fatalities to number of claims that we receive. So we're still receiving quite a large number of claims as a road accident fund. If I then take you to page 2, indicates the strategy that we've been following as a road accident fund to obviously turn around this organization. And it's critical that we understand some of the elements, that unless all the elements are working together, this entity will not be changed. So there is work that we're doing at the area with new systems and processes. And that's the investment that we looked at in IT and claims administration solutions. In fact, we've already gone live on a new claims administration solution on the 12th of October. And it's an area where I think it's going to have the most impact on staff and on our efficiencies. The press has already been speculating on major retrenchments and that sort of thing. We're working with Satau as our partners in this regard. And because it's a process that will take, you know, at least 18 months, and it depends on the funding that we're going to be getting, we certainly are improving efficiencies. And we're going to be retraining staff in this regard. But there are two important elements to our turnaround. And the first one being the legislative amendment. That scheme that the country has is a scheme that really doesn't serve its population. It's a scheme that is exceptionally wasteful. It's a scheme that doesn't allow ordinary South Africans to come and claim from us. So if you're an accident victim and you get involved in an accident, despite the fact that you pay for this cover and she lives, we make it absolutely difficult for you to come and claim from us, because to traverse all these complex legal issues to come and claim really doesn't help. It takes too long to claim because there's involvement of the court and everything else. And in fact, it's just far too complex, as we've indicated before. And we have to change the legislation. Most of the world has gone ahead. In fact, you know, even neighboring countries like Botswana, they've already left some of the legislation that we are still, sitting with. And it's an area that we believe attention is required. But I think we have to note, though, that Department of Transport and our minister is looking at this area, and we're hoping that the changes happen. It's just a little, we've been just a little slow in this regard, because we had a commission of inquiry that issued a report in 2002 already that recommended the North Force scheme, and we're waiting on the North Force scheme. We're still waiting on it 7 years afterwards, so hopefully we're going to move quickly on this. And the second element is the funding model. And we presented it to National Treasury. They've only partially used it. When they allocated 17.5 cents in Chile Levy, there's still an area where we believe we need a little bit more commitment in terms of using this model. Now, if I jump to page 6, just the 5-year review, again, I'll just skim through some of these because they have been covered. I think the 5-year review just indicates, starting on page 6, how we've been performing over the last 5 years. It's a lot of detail. I mean, there was a time, for instance, when our cash was, you know, at 3.6 billion on cash and cash equivalents there. But it also indicates at the bottom how our deficit has been increasing based on the provision for outstanding liability. So we won't go through that page. The important thing is page 8, some operational performance. Despite the fact that we actually have been constrained by the income and the cash that we receive in Chile Levy, you'll see that huge inroads have been made in the backlog of claims. The table at the top there indicates, it starts with the claims that are lost in the REF. You see that it's been increasing from about 185,000 each year to about 294. So under 300,000 claims are lost each year with us. And the proportion has changed. You'll see that we split it between supplier and non-supplier claims. Supplier claims are claims by hospitals, ambulance groups, and those sort of people. The supplier claims have increased from 58,000 in 2005. It's now sitting at around 128,000. Suppliers have actually developed confidence in our systems. The few people that are actually claiming directly from us that get paid directly. So they don't get paid through lawyers and that sort of thing. And you see that the finalization rate is much, much higher. And we don't even have a backlog in supplier claims now. So if you look at the claims that we finalized, despite the fact that new claims lots have been increasing, we've actually had to go finalize much more claims. So we've finalized 330,000 claims this year compared to 311 in the previous financial year. So our finalization rate has increased substantially. So the backlog of outstanding claims has dropped. I think it peaked at around 445,000. You'll see in 2006 there, it's now only 260,000. And in reality, if it wasn't cash constrained, we would have reduced this backlog significantly. Now, there is a big difference. The people who are benefiting from claiming directly from us, not using attorneys, has been suppliers. Again, ambulance groups and hospitals. You'll see that, they were sitting with a backlog of over 100,000 claims in 2005. is now reduced to a small amount, 23,000 claims. And we believe, though, that if we are able to get claimants to come directly to us, and we actually don't waste time arguing in court and that sort of thing, you'll get that benefit. So, in fact, that graph just across on the left-hand side shows this picture more clearly, that the backlog of claims from hospital groups has really reduced significantly. And there's hardly any backlog compared to I think, individual claimants. Now, there's a lot of data that we provide at the bottom, because what we do is we split the claims in the subcomponents. Initially, we're splitting them between suppliers and non-suppliers, but we also split them by heads of damage on page 9 there. So, you know, it's a pity, though, that if we start on page 8, that we only pay about 300 million out of that 11 billion to hospital groups. 300 million out of 11 billion directly to hospitals and ambulances and suppliers. And the only reason is actually you'll see it decreased slightly from 2008, 500 million to 300 million. That's because when we introduced the Amendment Act, some of the private hospital groups felt that it's a business that they're going to get out of because they're being compensated on public sector rates, and therefore they have reduced the involvement in this business. And it's an area that I think at the RES we'd like to change. I think it really helps us to see ordinary accident victims, ambulances picking them up, going past private hospitals and dumping them in government hospitals. And in fact, when somebody pays a fee for cover, there's no reason why you shouldn't get immediate medical attention and at the best available facility. And it's an area that we want to focus on. If you go to page 9, and I will run quickly through the rest of these ones. You'll see that general damages are still by far the largest portion of our claims, 4.9 billion compared to 3.9 billion last year. And in fact, if you look at how it increased over the years from 1.2 billion to 4.9, this is an era where we're wasting quite a lot of money. And this is the number of payments indicates where the volumes are. And when you look at the annual report later on, I think when you look at the number of payments, it tells you where most of the activities are. And in fact, if you look at the classes of damages, the classes of benefits that you pay, we've made 134,000 general damages payments. And if you go two blocks down to medical compensation, the volumes indicate the 161 is mainly supplier claims. But rent amount, we've only paid 800 million in medical compensation. And just so that there's no confusion between the 300 million supplier claims and 800 million, the 800 million includes past medical. So some people will come and claim, will pay out of their own pockets and then claim directly from the area. So that's why in total we paid 800 million compared to 5 billion that we pay in general damages. And legal costs, it's basically those two items at the bottom, the 1.6 and the 900 million. We'll go and look at them in a little more detail in a little while. If you go to page 11, you'll see that we provide regional data. I think most of the region actually contributed significantly to the reduction in the backlog of claims. If you start almost at the bottom of the first portion, the one that adds up to 445,000, you'll see that where we are at now is 260,000 outstanding claims. Most of our regional offices have really contributed to the reduction of claims. And the sub-complement by region is stated again on page 11 there. And Just a final section that I just want to take us to is just the review of operations, which is on page 32. Because we've gone through this in a little bit more detail before, what I'm going to do is just do a quick pictorial tour just on the graphs that are attached to the annual report, just to give an indication of where we are as a business. Some of these we've looked at earlier on. So the graph on page 32 there, the graph 4.1, just shows you our revenue. 4.2 indicates the source of it, the 2.5 billion being the revenue, the cash injection we got from government. Fuel levy sold, you'll see that it dropped from 18 million megaliters to 17.6 megaliters. So the economy has actually slowed down, I think, the fuel levy income a little bit. If you go down to on page 33 there, you'll see that fuel levy income is still less than, well, as a percentage of fuel levy sold, it's around 7%, so it's still pretty low. So it's not a major burden, I think, to motorists yet, and there's still room for it to increase. Graph 4.6 indicates the diesel rebate. This is the amount of money we repay to industry, people who pay for diesel, who are using it in their manufacturing activities. It's now grown to 876 million. And investment income, we've already covered it, basically interest income. If you go to page 34, our total expenditure of 23 billion. If you look at admin costs, they're small compared to the bulk of our costs. If you look at 23 billion and you think admin costs is 534, small proportion of it. And some of these is cut out already, graph 4.9. 12 billion of all advance payments is the provision this year. Graph 4.10 shows you the decline in the backlog, so it really has been a substantial decline over the year. On page 35, graph 4.11 indicates the increase in the number of claims lodged with the rotation fund, so it hasn't been going down. In fact, the last 2 years, really shot through the sky, and part of it also being supplier claims because of our improved efficiency. And 4.12 indicates how successful we've been in finalizing claims, and particularly supplier claims. 4.13 and 4.14 shows you an age analysis of our claims. So the idea though is to ensure that claims do not sit in our system for too long. And in fact, if you go to graph 4.14 on page 36, it will indicate to you that claims greater than 3 years has dropped 20% over the last 5 years. Claims between 2 and 3 years has dropped 23%, and claims between 1 and 2 years, 15%. So we, most of our spending claims are actually younger claims that we have. I won't go through some of these graphs. If you have jump to graph 4.17 and 4.18, 4.17 still indicates that we pay too much in legal costs, 2.5 billion of the payments that we made. Just a 12 billion is in legal costs. But it gets worse. On page 4.18, you'll see that contingency fees, this is success fee that is taken by lawyers, is as much as 4.3 billion. So in reality, all the claimants are left with is that tiny 4.3 billion. So remember, we paid around just under 12 billion to use round numbers. The lawyers are taking 2.5 billion and the 4.3 billion in success fee, which we still think that it's money that should have been reaching accident victims, and it's an area that we need to look at. And another area is on graph 4.19, shows you how wasteful our system is. We're supposed to actually focus on fixing people's broken bones and their bodies and that. But if you look at how much we pay in medical costs, and, you know, it's kind of the gray element there. It's really small compared to what we pay in general damages, loss of earnings. Our system is still not where it should be. And on page 38, just undertakings, our active undertakings are small. There's about 2,500 active undertakings out of 2,100,000. And by the way, most people do heal. This is not like a medical aid where you expect illnesses to be chronic and to continue forever. So if your bones have mended, under normal circumstances, you shouldn't come back to us. So, you know, although active undertakings may look low compared to total undertakings we've issued, it's also related to the nature of our business. And we only paid 80 million on graph 4.21 there in undertakings. Undertakings are just promises that we give individuals to cover their debts in the future. Now, the rest of the graph just analyzes in detail the performance of our business and for each class of damages, and we won't go through them. And if you jump to page 43, I think it's just a pictorial indicating graph 4.41 there shows you how our efficiencies have been. You'll see the claims analyzed per staff member has gone up to 205. If it wasn't because of the shortage of cash, our productivity would have been much better. And the rest of the graph are just our liquidity and that. So Madam Chair, this is a picture of how we performed over the years. So it's been a combination of successes despite the fact that we've been constrained by cash flow. So if it wasn't for the fact that we're not receiving sufficient income, that backlog that's dropped over 40%, we believe it could have been much lower. So that's where I'll probably just stop, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair, Mr. Madisa, for highlighting some of the successes and challenges that we're experiencing as well. Members, can we interact with the report? Honorable Lucas.
I want to sympathize with the RAF.
Honorable Fritter.
I just like to sympathize with the RAF because we don't seem to be going forward. And there are obvious things that are there. First of all, the legal issue. I thought that would be solved because that takes the cream of this whole situation. Why aren't we solving? Who is getting rich? Someone's getting rich out of this, benefiting from all this year. And you know, if the people who were injured are getting something out of this, one could appreciate it. But if you look at most cases, it's only the people who can afford it who are getting a good benefit. The lawyer still comes, they win the case, and the person who is injured sits at home and sometimes gets 500 rand a month or 2,000 rand a month out of the bed from a trust fund or belonging to a lawyer. So all these things are very things. But what is very hurtful when we start talking about increasing the fuel levy? I should say to the RAF, we are paying too much for our fuel. We can't afford it. In the Trinity, now we're going to go to fuel levy. I don't know how we're going to survive. This is not what we fought for. Liberation meant that we're going to be liberated and better people. But every organization seems to want to push us back and pretend that we are all getting a million rand a year. People are living off 1,500, 1,200 rand a month.
better ways of trying to get funds for.
And we go back again. What's causing the accident? We don't look at that. We are not looking at that situation. We should look at that, because if you reduce the accident rate, the whole thing will have an effect on the road accident rate. But I will come back to it. The issue with lawyers, the CEO took a very brave stand at one stage, and I was saying, okay, I'm going to be his bodyguard. But he lost out on this issue. And it was a fair issue. The whole country would be behind him, because he was correct. He was absolutely correct. You get injured, you have a car accident, you complain immediately, you go straight to RAF, you get paid out, finish and last. Now you get the lawyer, he's going to add on, he says, oh, then, oh, what about your neck? What about this here? He starts adding on these things. So that is what hurts me. Because I'm not sure how we're going to rectify this. And then the other one here, you've got $15 billion of interest on the sheriff and interest. It shouldn't be there really in the first place, but it is there. And of course it's an accumulation of many, many years. I know in old days when I was still young, we used to pay third party. And once you pay the third party, you were free. You could drive alone. Now we wait and they say, oh no, third party's not bringing enough funds. And there were complaints from some people who were using their cars in that. So pay on the petrol maybe. Could have been a good idea, but it doesn't seem to work out, because it's easy milking the cow that is producing the most milk. You can say, well, let's go to the levy, then we'll increase. I just say, let's look at this thing and look at both. And we will support the RAF, because we know, and they know, what is wrong. Thank you.
Sorry, Madam Chair. The first is the one of the presenters just tell us at what stage are we with tabling some kind of amendments with regards to legislation changes. The last presentation we heard that they had gone through to the minister, I understand. To which stage are we at? They could also advise us. I see one of the graphs indicates that there are some rather old claims going back quite a number of years. What are the reasons for these
very old claims, and why were they still there, and when were they to be resolved?
And then somewhere in the presentation, I made a note, but I can't find it right now, is you also mentioned for assessors. That assess the actual injured. What is the procedure? Does each person that has submitted a claim get assessed by the RAF? What is the procedure there? How does it work? I think, Madam Chair, depending on that answer, I'd then like to ask a follow up question. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you,
Honorable Chair. I think we really share the sentiments that were expressed by our first speaker, the Honorable Richard, because the solutions are there. You know, we've had 7 commissions of inquiry into the scheme. I mean, this is a scheme that was developed in the 40s. I know it's probably pushing a little bit, but it's an accepted era that shouldn't still be around. And 7 commissions of inquiry have provided solutions. We know what the answers are. We just, as a country, we've been exceptionally slow in implementing some of the solutions. I mean, if you think about it, had we implemented recommendations by the Special Commission by now, I guess by the time the SOSH came into the country, in, I think, 2002, we actually wouldn't have paid the $500 million that we paid to that individual. So I think what this requires is really, I think, not only commitment, but strength, because there's no doubt that we have a very strong lobby in the legal fraternity. They have frustrated every single step that the Department of Transport and the ministries have tried to implement to change the scheme. And they are benefiting. And every time they take every single change to the Constitutional Court but I still believe that we shouldn't use those as excuses. I think a few people cannot overcome the will of the majority, and I think it's an area where there's a lot of work that I think we need to do. But I do agree, though, that we shouldn't just simply increase the fuel levy. The bottom line, though, is all we need to do is plug the holes. We know that we are wasting 2.5 billion rands in legal costs. Just plug that hole. The 2.5 billion goes towards accident victims, so you don't need to go and increase fuel levy. What we pay in contingency fees, that 4.3 billion, just plug the holes. We just stop it from happening. And suddenly 4.3 billion is now suddenly available to accident victims. And some of the wastages that we have in general damages where people are claiming who are not injured, we know the solutions. The difficulty, and I think this is where as a board and as management, we obviously keep expressing our frustrations, is that this business model is coded in legislation. It requires, I think, work being done by both our ministry and obviously Parliament to ensure that we come up with the right kind of law. All we need to do is really change the law. It should not take 5 years for a claimant to claim from the RAF. We want a scheme where if somebody gets involved in an accident, they get picked up on the road. They are assured two things. The ambulance group knows that it will be paid and will be paid immediately. We also want to get to a situation where the ambulance doesn't go past private hospitals, that they actually get the best treatment that is available at the time. I mean, this is 12 billion rand we're talking about here. There's no reason why people should die while they're being transported past private hospitals to and get dumping in other areas. Now, we need a scheme where claimants, the scheme should not be so complex that an ordinary South African cannot claim. So, and by the way, the schemes are there, and there's no reason why we shouldn't have those schemes. And I think that's the area that I agree that we shouldn't increase the fuel levy alone. We should just plug the hole. I think, the area of sheriff costs and interest and the causes of the accident, it's an area that you'll see in our mission. That's an area that we think we want to focus on, because we'd rather prevent the incidents rather than obviously have to pay afterwards. So that's the first set of questions. I think the second set of questions are, in terms of the Amendment Act, I will ask, I think, representatives from the Department of Transport to come in. Perhaps if I just indicate, though, that a lot of work has been done in this regard, and drafts have gone through to the state law attorneys and that, but in terms of when the exact dates are, I will defer to some officials for the Department of Transport to indicate when the amendment legislations are going to come in. But remember that even those amendments are there to plug the holes, we still have a fundamental problem in the scheme. We need a Norfolk scheme, and until we have those, we'll still have a problem. The graph that honourable member is referring to that indicates all claims, and that's a graph that was on page. Let's see that page again. Well, page 36. If you go to page 36, so the question was, why do we still have some of those old claims? Once a claim has been stuck in the legal system and you're waiting for court dates and that sort of thing, our preference is to settle those claims as quickly as we can. But again, it takes two to tango, and often once you've got summonses and court processes. You know, most of the parties only deliver information just before the court date, and all those sort of things. It's there's a lot of work that we still like to work on with I think with our attorneys to ensure that we can settle these things quicker. But the real solution is in fact to remove the, you know, the need for the legal system to settle a claim. People pay for insurance, and we'd like for them to be paid as quickly as we can. So part of the reason is precisely that. The assessor, the assessment that I was referring to was the AMA guys. One of the changes that has come in the Amendment Act is aimed at limiting general damages. That $4.9 billion that we take in general damages, the amendments that were introduced on the 1st of October are aimed at limiting them. So what that provision says is that only people who are seriously injured would then be allowed to claim general damages. And for someone to be able to claim the general damages, they go through an assessment of the serious injury, and that assessment is done by medical doctors who are trained in this regard. We're using AMA guides. We've agreed this as a tool with Department of Health. So not everybody goes through an assessment like this. Only those individuals who are seriously injured and they'd like to claim general damages will go through that assessment. So it's not everybody that needs to go through. Those were the answers, Honorable Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, with regard to the amendment bill, currently still in the draft stages, as the CEO indicated, Chairperson, in drafting the bill, proper consultation, legal opinion counsel needs to be consulted, and implementing certain sections of the Road Accident Fund, current Road Accident Fund Act, and therefore proper consultation. More specifically, with the legal counsel needs to be contacted further, because as you raised, that the legal fraternity is the weight for chances to actually hold back pieces of legislation when it comes to many sections of the act that actually has an adverse effect on the legal fraternity. So currently, we are in the process of almost finalized. I won't say finalized, almost finalizing, and most probably we would take it to the State Law Advisor to actually look at the final draft. Chairperson.
So this department has any deadline for the finalization of the bill?
Please say, Chairperson.
The deadline and the plan in place. When are you intending to finalize this bill? Because it's every time as soon as possible, prolong the process. So we want this deadline. When is the bill going to be finalized? Because some of the amendments are the ones that hampers the activities of the RAF. We need to fast track that bill so that at the end of the day, RAF will be able to deal with some of the challenges that are experienced.
Yes, Chairperson, I hear the concerns of the committee. One has to realize also that we would ask our State Law Advisor to see as soon as the bill is almost finalized to put it onto the legislative program for the committee to look at.
On behalf of the committee, can I request that we get a written commitment on the DK for the finalization of the bill so that we don't keep on discussing one and the same thing. We need to close this matter and look at the other challenges that will be confronting the RAF.
Yes, Chairperson, can we convey the response to the committee secretary, Chairperson?
Okay, members. Honorable Christmas, is it a follow-up or a new question? Follow-up. Okay. followed by Honourable Member Malule.
I've listened very carefully to the full presentation and to what was said earlier on and the responses to my question. And I find it very interesting because the, and I'm very keen to see what the proposed legislative proposal amendments would be. Because the idea would be to, and I'm not speaking on anybody's behalf, but I talk from my personal experience that I submitted a claim to the RAF and had no response. It was only when I had to was forced to put in legal people that I started getting a response. And I'd be very interested to hear what is considered a serious injury because I was confined to a wheelchair for almost 2 years. And I recently got a response of a settlement figure that wouldn't even cover the medical expenses. And that would have been the RAF's payments to my claim, which has gone into hundreds of thousands of rands of medical expenses, and I will continue to have expenses for the rest of my life because of this accident. And the figure was so insulting, and the psychology that goes behind it was just so appalling that I was forced to have you to have used lawyers to deal with this process. So now it's gone back to ask the RAF to reconsider it and look at it, because the figure was less than any of the expenses I had spent. So I'm very interested to hear the legislative, because it all sounds very good on paper until you see on the practice. And I've got the advantage or disadvantage, however you look at it, of actually going through a process right now on a claim. Now, I'm very lucky in many ways in that I have access to attorneys. I can have access to these things. I'm literate and all that kind of thing. I'm thinking about a person who can't read and write, who has no access, wouldn't know where to start, wouldn't know what to do. And now, if I'm that thing, can you imagine somebody who's in a poor community who is completely lost and alone in the situation? So I look very, very eagerly towards these legislative amendments, because it's all very well and easy to say let's get these the legal people out of the way and everything's going to run very well. Let me tell you that it has been an appalling process that I've been going through and I continue to go through the RAF. And I can tell you the only efficiency and smoothness in this process that I've seen are from the lawyers. That's my experience. I'd be very interested to hear what a serious injury is. I mean, does somebody have to lose all their limbs and all their, you know, half their organs to be considered serious? And, in order for the RAF to want it to be that the legal process is completely out, it means responsibility on their side to make sure that things are done in a certain way. And I really am very skeptical based on my own experience. Thank you very much.
Very simple question. Why can't ambulances drive to the nearest crime hospital? Can you put a bit of a lighter note? You know, the CEO is so almost bragging about staff complement. Staff complement, but I know you're not responsible for thinking your own board, but Johan can't say that about your board. Thank you.
I just wanted to follow up on my colleagues. I don't think anyone is saying to turn on the lawyers. If you can afford it, go to the legal. But the poor people have it from both sides. They go, the lawyers take it on, put it on, put a figure on it, rip them off, and they rip off for that. So if you can afford the legal person, there's nothing stopping you. There's nothing stopping you getting legal assistance.
Honorable Mike.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. Just one question. CEO said something about more claims and the levy that they receive. $15 million was incurred through sheriff and interest costs. So I'm just lost. How do you intend to solve this? I mean, you want to slow down, and when you slow down, you pay $15 million, and if you don't slow down, the claims are more than the levy. How do we get out of that one? Thank you.
So maybe can you get the status of the advisory committee as indicated by Mr. Mashan, because we're looking at the report, some of the board expired in July. And what is the progress with the government?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Again, I'm going to say to the Department of Transport, it is true that the term of the board expired, at the end of July. And I know there were adversely issues in terms of our aid to make new appointments, but again, this is a preserve of the minister, and let me first defer the particular question to the Department of Transport.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the rest of the committee term expired at the end of July 2009. What had happened is that due to the change in the minister, from Minister Adebe to Minister Ndebele, the term of the board would come to an end. It was advertised, but the nominations that were received, the minister wasn't too happy with the list that was received, and subsequently the effort was re-advertised, calling for a more wider net of nominations so the minister can have a look at. Currently, the shortlist has been drawn up, and the minister actually, the ministry actually has the documentation with regard to the shortlist, and the minister would naturally appoint from that shortlist a board. But also, the time process that takes to actually advertise needs to be put in the media, government gazette. Wait for a certain number of months before we actually receive nomination. So there actually there's time left, which actually takes place. Then on the other issue, the due to the IAS board expiring, and it cannot be without a board. And in terms of the PFMA, which is section 49.2, if there's no board, which is expired, which when a board expires and there's no board. In terms of the minister can appoint a controlling body or an advisory body to be the accounting authority of the board until he appoints a board. So therefore, we are at this stage now, in terms of the PFM, that we can't have an advisory board to the minister.
Let me just address some of the questions that they arose, and I think there has been, you know, my response to the first set of questions. There is no excuse for the REF not dealing with, I think, the honourable member's claim as expeditiously as. And as appropriately as it should have. There's no doubt that there's inherent behavior that you know, may arise from the past that needs to be resolved. And there's a lot of work that we're doing in that regard. If you think about it, the REF has acted no different from a law firm. The new systems and processes that we're introducing, in fact, are designed to go beyond that. So we're going to be treating accident victims as individuals rather than pieces of response on paper. But just to put this serious injury and those sort of things in context, and some of the I think the issues that are raised by the honourable member that are relating to specimen figure being not even covering medical costs. We need to understand what the RES is here to do. And the best thing to understand, though, is to look at the nature of compensation we pay. In the first instance, what we pay is all the past and future hospital costs. That's the class of benefits we provide accident victims. We're not supposed to pay a cent less and a cent more. And there is no reason at all that we should be giving a settlement for medical expenses that is a cent more or a cent less than what you have physically incurred in getting medical treatment. Our law doesn't allow us to do so. So if somebody is making an offer that is less than the actual medical cost, unless there's obviously application of the false scheme that requires of us to apportion costs because of apportionment of damages, because of fault. Remember, what fault does is to the extent that you're 60% at fault, the law, again, is a problem. Does require offers to apportion damages in that respect. However, the way our law is structured currently, there is no way that we are allowed. If you incur 10,000 rand in medical costs and we don't have to apply apportionment of damages in terms of our legislation because of fault, there's no reason why we shouldn't be paying a cent. We shouldn't be paying fully the medical costs. Now, and that also covers future medical costs. That's why we issue entities called undertakings. But, you know, where do you see the abuse? And we'll come back to the abuse in a little while. But where you see abuse is that people are claiming from the road accident fund who are not genuinely injured. And again, I'm going to just emphasize this by saying that we paid 12 billion last year, 12 billion rand. We only paid around 800 million in medical costs. This is a scheme that is designed to go and help people repair their bodies, repair their medical injuries and that sort of thing. And for us to be paying 800 million shows that there's a huge element of abuse in the scheme. What typically happens is people get involved in bumper dashing accidents where the car literally only has a scratch. And what happens is they go to doctors, and doctors obviously say to doctors, my neck is sore, and what doctors say is they write an accident report. And what they claim in medical costs is probably the 200 rand consultation fee or 90 rand or whatever the case is. And then they claim the balance in general damages and damages that have got nothing to do with the injury. And this is reflected in the amount of payment that we are making. You see, our statistics do not lie. This is exactly what they are. What we also do is we issue what we call an undertaking. An undertaking is medical certificate to cover all accident victims' future medical costs. You know how much claims we get for those undertakings? You'll see our numbers here, it's gone up to only 80 million. 80 million. In the five-year review there, you'll see that we're paying a small amount for future medical costs. Small amount. We pay 12 billion and only 80 million for people where we're giving them a certificate and we're saying, you know, you're going to be looked after in the future. Again, it shows that, you know, we pay more money for non-injury-related accidents than we are paying for the injuries themselves. But they have just to complete the picture in terms of how serious injury comes into play. What the RES or our legislation says is that we pay in full your medical costs, we pay in full your loss of earnings, and your loss of support. So to the extent that obviously we ever got involved in an accident, passed away, we look after the family. We pay in full funeral expenses. So those we think we are paying in full. But the problem though is this sorry money that we pay over and above your medical costs, then that's what we call general damages. And this is the only place where the definition of serious injury come into play. We do not use serious injury when somebody is claiming medical costs. So if somebody only had a consultation of 200 rand, we pay in full every single cent of your medical cost. It's only when you come and claim the sorry money, the general damages, which is loss of amenities of life, this is the only time where the issue of serious injury comes in. And that's where we then apply the assessment that we spoke about. Now, in terms of the Amendment Act, we did not go and define serious injury. What we had done is we set up a tool for the assessment of an area where individuals need to, well, a sort of a yardstick that individuals need to pass to qualify to claim general damages. And remember, this is only to claim general damages, not to claim medical costs, which we would have paid in full. So all that assessment tool does is that it requires of you to have been, you know, at least 30% impaired. It's an impairment assessment that medical professionals, doctors who are qualified to apply the August tools use to indicate a sort of a qualification point only for general damages. So I think from the question that's raised by I think the honourable member there is that you do not need to be seriously injured to claim medical costs from the RES. As long as you've been involved in an accident, we are supposed to pay every single cent of your medical costs as long as there is no apportionment of damages. You do not need to be seriously injured. We only apply the yardstick of serious injury if you claim the sorry money, which is the 5 billion rand that we're paying each year, which still being, I think, where the abuse is happening. But I think in terms of what will come in the Amendment Act and some of the changes, to understand it, we need to really understand what is wrong with our scheme. I have to say that I think sympathize with the honourable member, because what they're sharing is exactly the same frustrations that we think should not pertain in a scheme of this nature. Our scheme is complex. An ordinary South African cannot come and claim from us. Now, it's because it's based on this law of delict, where you have to go make complex calculations. Well, the law is just to prove forward, but you know, you also have to make complex calculations, present value of all your future income, and how you're going to become. You need actuaries to come and determine your income for the rest of your life. It's a lot of it is I call it crystal ball gazing. The scheme is exceptionally subjective. So an ordinary South African cannot go there and say, I know what my loss of income is going to be in the future. So one of the areas that we're wanting to do is to come up with a legislation that is simple, that allows ordinary South Africans to not require experts to come and claim from the RES. Simple means that you do not need to go and know the law to come and claim from us. All we need to do is to say you've been involved in an accident, you are entitled to payment of medical costs, and this is what you get, or you're entitled to payment of loss of earnings, this is what you get. We want to remove subjectivity. That subjectivity arises where you have to calculate quantum, because to go and calculate quantum, again, you need to be an actuary, because you have to go and say, what am I going to be like for the rest of my life? What career am I going to become? And I know I use this example that the sort of thing that we are supposed to determine, and we have experts that say they know the answer to those questions. The sort of things we're supposed to determine, as an example, is if you're a 5-year-old child, we're supposed to go map up your whole schooling career and then go and determine what job you're going to get and what that job is going to look like, what promotions you're going to get for the rest of your life. And then we have experts who think that they know better. Even the judges, the judiciary, go and determine, what your career prospects are like. Invariably, it's also sort of discriminatory in the sense that it perpetuates some of the inequalities of the past. So if you're a 5-year-old kid and your parents are domestic worker or whatever the case is, the courts actually come out and say this is all you're going to become for the rest of your life. That, you know, because your parentage just happens to be, of that education and skill, therefore the rest of your life you're going to just become like that. You're also going to become a domestic worker. And it's really iniquitous. And we cannot have a scheme where somebody cannot sit down today and say, I've been involved in an accident, and how much loss of income am I going to get? And where iniquities of the past are perpetuated. So those are some of the elements of changes that we need to introduce in the scheme. We need everybody to know that my loss of income will be X or Y, and I don't need an expert to come in and discuss this. I have to say that it's still said that honorable member has had to go and feel the need to only go to lawyer to claim from us, and I think it shows fundamentally that our scheme is really flawed, and a scheme that we need to look at. Let me just address the rest of the other questions. Why can't ambulances take people directly to private hospitals? I think again there is a flaw in our legislation. Our legislation, including the Amendment Act that was passed in 2008, has got two provisions. I think the first provision says that if you require emergency medical treatment, we can pay as a road accident fund based on the rate that we have negotiated, which in reality is private sector rate. We use NHRPL, which is the National Health Reference Price List, which is the sort of rate that is by medical aid. But that's a private, that's only for to stabilize it in an emergency. And it still says that for ongoing medical treatment, the hospitals are compensated on UPSS, which is public sector tariffs. A lot of private hospitals have said that because they're not actually going to be compensated on the basis of a tariff that allows them to even recover their costs, they're not prepared to treat accident victims. And it's sad, because I think from where we stand, it shouldn't be that way. We have ordinary South Africans paying for cover. We're paying through the kid levy. There's no reason why we should limit you in terms of the medical treatment you should get. And in fact, you'll see that in the amendments that hopefully will come and say through this committee, we'd like to change that. What we'd like to do is that 800 million out of 12 billion that we pay in medical costs, we'd rather reverse it and ensure that we save people's lives. And remember, it also has other benefits, that if we can help you as soon as possible, you're no longer a sort of an ongoing burden to society, because you get as quickly medical treatment as you can. And and if you can get attention ASAP, not only do you save your life, you don't have ongoing requirements for treatment. So we really want to support a system where ambulances will not go past private hospitals, that they will actually drop you even at a private hospital. The issue I think of the board has been addressed. What name? Sorry? There is an issue to keep
in mind. The response to the three chairs.
Yeah.
Whether that was a comment by the Honorable Member Honorable, I think, regarding the constitution of the board in terms of the representativity. Yes. When we started as a board chairperson, we were 9 members, and I think we were split almost equally. There was 5 men and 4 women, and one of the women was a chairperson. So then one of the women actually resigned on the first day, I think, at our workshop. We went until very late, and she complained that she could not take it, and she resigned on the first day. So they were never replaced. And a few years thereafter, the chairperson resigned because I was deputy, and then I acted up until the end of our chair. I was only appointed the chair of the advisory committee now in July. So that is the status. So we're well representative in Biden.
And then the final set of questions related to claims with the steel levy and the slowdown in the processing of claims and the 50 million sheriff cost that we have there. I know we made 2 statements. We made a statement that we actually prefer a scheme where we track the wastages, the holds, where rather than have 2.5 billion each year being wasted in legal costs going out of the system. And amounts that we pay in general damages for areas where people are not seriously injured. That if you plug those holes, you're going to find that the field levy will not increase, will not need to be as high as it currently is. But at the same time, we said we still have a backlog of claims. I think the confusion arises out of the fact that there's 2 elements. There's a legacy of the past that we need to deal with, and that's the legacy where I think our actuaries have said that we've got an outstanding liability of 42 billion rand. Now, that liability arises out of the scheme as it was before the Amendment Act, where we pay an unlimited amount in your own currency and everything else. So our field levy has to cover the past, the backlog. Somebody has to pay. That's 63 billion rand in nominal terms, or 42 billion in present value terms, that we're saying we're sitting in a hole for. Somebody needs to pay. And unfortunately, it's often our future generation that pays for this, as long as we leave the field levy as low as it is, as long as the field levy doesn't allow us to settle the backlog. Now, 2 things. When we presented the model to National Treasury, the model to determine the field levy was intended to do 2 things: to address the payment for the backlog and payment for a scheme that will continue in the future. So it hasn't been fully applied yet, and that's why we keep running out of cash. And that's why we ran out of cash last year, and that resulted in that 15 million sheriff cost. That model, for instance, for this current financial year, indicated that if we clear the backlog over a period of 5 years, the total fuel levy that we required was in the region an increase of 34 cents a litre. We only received 17 cents a litre, which means that we will still keep running into some sort of cash flow constraints. So if we're able to put these issues in the little blocks, I think you're going to find that we're able to address the issues. If we look at the backlog, we need to fund the backlog either through a fuel levy or cash injections or some other mechanism, because it's a legacy that needs to be addressed. That's the first thing. The second thing is we need to fund a scheme that ideally should be a scheme that's not wasteful. At the moment, it's still pretty wasteful, but we need a field levy to cover the future. And even if we introduce no fault and that sort of thing today, we'll still have to pay for the past. So you still have to see field levy increasing and then coming down the line. Now, the slowdown in the processing of claims reflects precisely this issue, that appeal levy income, we received $8.8 billion in field levy income last year. We needed to pay $11 billion, even after slowing down the processing of claims, $11 billion in claims. Now, the field levy income is far too small for us to pay for current claims and the backlog of claims. And that's why we've made inroads in reducing the backlog, but not as much as we would have liked as the REF. So, you know, the consequences of this has been those shared costs. So maybe in summary, as it relates to this, is the reason we're slowing down the processing of claims is because our income doesn't allow us to process as many claims as we can. If we slow down the processing of claims, there are consequences, like the sheriff comes in, because we have a very hostile legal profession that, you know, would rather come in and make attachment orders on our assets and that sort of thing, as opposed to work with us. So, you know, they do all these summonses and sheriff costs, and that's why we spend $15 million. So it shows that there's elements that are not quite balanced yet in our solution, which we need to work on. Thank you, Madam Chair.
We want to ask.
My name is Dr. Aslam Dossin. And have been on the board until July, and now I'm still continuing as a member of the advisory committee. I think it's important for this committee in particular to understand that after all is said and done, there is really nothing more that can be done with the RAF as it exists that hasn't already been done in terms of keeping it afloat and keeping it on a steady course. But I know for a fact, and so should you by now, that it is, while it's still steady, it is the Titanic. And it will go with a $65 billion nominal deficit. The Minister of Finance would be hard-pressed to take us seriously, given that his own budget deficit is of that order. So now we begin to understand the scale of the hole in the economy that this thing creates. It has within it the seeds of its own destruction. You know, we spoke about the legal problems. While we can try and plug the hole by getting the lawyers out of the system, the billions we pay to the lawyers are billions being paid. In other words, you've got to take those billions away from them. You think they're going to let you? Forget it. The same thing happened with the medical profession, in the medical schemes industry. When you try to shift things away from people who are earning it, you get a huge reaction and a huge fight. So this is not something that we're going to be able to resolve. The legal profession is very powerful. It extends right through into the judiciary. This is something that will have to happen at the diplomatic level, at the state level, if we're going to get somewhere with this. Most importantly, this hole in the economy has got to be ring-fenced at some point and closed off, whether it's just a backlog or it's current structure which continues to increase the deficit, whatever. And the new scheme put in place. Now, the only people who can do that, of course, the government and the legislature. Only you have the power to do that. Only you can pass the legislation for the new road accident benefit scheme that's mooted in the Statutory Commission. What we can do is still keep the Titanic afloat for as long as possible. However, as Jacob said, future generations are going to pay for this. And there's no amount of intensive management you're going to apply to this thing to make it turn around. It is a dead man walking. It must be shut down. The sooner, the better. And the new scheme put in place. New scheme should focus on medical treatment and rehabilitation only, like everywhere else in the world. This country must be, it's part of its social security policy. And this scheme should be very much a part of that, rather than some kind of slush fund for lawyers and for people to thumbs up how much they would have made if they weren't injured. Again, I must emphasize, we can only do so much. Really, it's up to you to get this thing fixed.
you very much, but I believe that together we can change things, not on the earth, but together with Ralph, we can make things happen. Members, I think we've come to the end of our meeting. Let me take this opportunity to thank the CEO, the board members, and also the department for being part of this meeting. I think as members we've noticed the challenges that are facing RAF, and we're still going to sit as a committee and look at how best can we assist where we're supposed to go to assist. And while on the other side, RAF has got an assignment to go back and see what is it that they can do to deal with some of the challenges that are facing RAF. For all of us, to make sure that at the end of the day, we are out of this hole. At the end of the day, you are able to execute your mandate. But it's going to be a process, not an event, but we'll try our best to make sure that we clearly fix the holes that you've identified that hinder you.